Anyway, so we have our last session, and we do have quite a lot of material to get through. So what I would like to try to do is to see if we can make it through the remainder of the material. It's perhaps not as intimidating as it looks, because there is quite a lot of repetition. But nevertheless, there's still quite a substantial amount. So I'll ask for your cooperation. I suspect, unless a miracle happens, that we won't get it finished before 11. So is that alright? We can have a like break in the middle or something like that. I mean, if it's too much, you can always go up and go back to your room and do some practice. But that's our only hope, as far as I can see. Okay, so let's get going. And so far we've looked at the section on the observation of dhammas, of principles, and I've tried to look at it mainly from the perspective of what I believe to be the original form of that, which is essentially the contemplation of the hindrances and awakening factors, i.e. the reflection back and understanding of the forces that are leading to the obstacles and to the supporting of your meditation practice, okay? And that's what I think Dhammanupassana is actually about, okay? Now, as we remarked a little bit yesterday, because the word Dhamma is very ambiguous, it's used in many different contexts, so it seems as if this particular section became used as like a catch-all for anything could be kind of stuck in there, and more things got stuck in there over time. Now, one of the most significant changes is one which is actually somewhat, how do I put this, somewhat disturbing even, is the fact that if this particular discourse that we've translated here, notice that the title it says in middle collection number 10, so the Majjhima Nikaya number 10, and there are, of course, two versions of this sutta in the Pali canon, the Majjhima Nikaya version and the Digha Nikaya version, the long discourses. And in the long discourses, it is, of course, supposed to be longer. But in fact, in the Pali edition that we use on Sutta Central, the middle-length version and the long version are identical. Okay, and this is a very, very serious piece of textual corruption. And it's one that I became aware of a number of years ago. It's one I feel very, how do I put this, very tormented by. In the fact that we're hosting this text, which I believe to be deeply inauthentic, on a site which is supposed to be about early Buddhism. But what can I say? Right? That's just the way it goes. And so I chose to translate the entire text when I did the translation, simply out of, I guess, honesty to my translation project. So my translation project is to translate this particular Pali text, and that's what this Pali text has in it, regardless of my thoughts about how authentic that is. Now, in fact, the historical situation is that the various Satipatthana suttas, probably an early version of the Satipatthana Sutta was inherited by the different schools in the period around King Ashoka, and that would have included in the Dhamma section the two that we've mentioned so far, the five hindrances and the seven awakening factors. In the period after the time of Ashoka, as the different schools emerged, gradually other practices were added to those under the influence of the respective Abhidhamma movements within those schools. So we're talking like a period between 200 and 400 years after the Buddha. And in most cases, those extra practices that were added and passages that were added were simply sort of standard passages that are found many, many other places elsewhere in the suttas, which are more or less just cut and pasted and put in this particular spot. The different schools do that in various different ways. And if you want to look at the comparison of the differences, you have a look at my book on the history of mindfulness. But there's too much to go into all of that here. Now, that would have brought to a close, the period, as I said, between 200 years after the Buddha, maybe a little later. Now, in the Pali tradition, apparently uniquely, the tradition felt the need to double the sutta and include it in two collections. Now, what is going on here probably is driven by the nature of the reciter's tradition at that time. And if we understand something about the reciter's tradition, we can understand something about why they may have chosen to do this. Now, it seems that what the early Sangha did when they organized the scriptures into what today we call the Nikayas or the Agamas, okay, is that they organized them into... Now, this is mainly applicable to the four Nikayas or the four Agamas. The last one, the Kudika, is somewhat of a miscellaneous collection and isn't sort of directly parallel. But let's just consider these four Nikayas or four Agamas. Now, in one sense, these are all distinguished by fairly straightforward criterion. The Digha has longer discourses, Majjhima has middle length, Samyutta is organized by topic, and the Anguttara is organized according to number, numerical discourses, or perhaps even the incremental discourses. Okay, so that's one way of organizing it. And what would happen is that the Sangha, you see, because there's too many suttas, right? This is the problem. See, this is like the driving force in Buddhist culture, okay? Mm. Right, there's just too many suttas, right? And we look at them, and right, you look at them, and you think, oh, how can I read all of these? How can I study them? There's just too many. There's like thousands of suttas. How can I find all of these things, right? Okay? But the solution in the early community was, there's so many suttas, we can't learn them all. How do we learn them all? By making more. Right? By making more suttas. That's how we can learn them all. Okay? The you know, you can whinge all you like about how there are so many suttas and things like that. The fact that there are so many suttas is why writing was invented, manuscripts were invented in ancient India. It is why the book was invented, okay? The book was invented in China, printing was invented in China in order to print the Buddha suttas, because it was too damn expensive to keep copying out all of these suttas by hand. That's why we have writing today. That's why we have printed books. That's why we have information technology, okay? Ultimately, that's why we have computers and all of these kinds of things. So, stop whinging, all right? It's true, right? Well, that's why these technologies were invented. And also computers, right? Computers depend on Buddhism. You never thought of that, right? Where does computers, we all know, what are computers? Ones and zeros, right? Where does zero come from? We all know, there's no zero in ancient Rome, there's no zero in ancient Greece, medieval Europe. They got the zero from India. Where does it come from? It comes from the idea of sunyata. It was because in Buddhism, the idea came that the absence of something is just as significant as the presence of it. Yeah? This is absolutely anathema in the Catholic tradition. Right? In the Catholic tradition, absence is evil. Mm-hmm. Existence is good. Right? And so you can't have a system where zero is valued like that. So zero is an Indian concept that ultimately comes from Buddhist philosophy. That's why we can have computers. So think about that next time you're checking Facebook on your smartphone. Thank you, Buddha. Okay. Anyway, this is all a little bit beside the point. But anyway, coming back to that thing. Okay, so we've got to think about how we can organize our texts, right? There's too many. So what we have to do is we have to split the Sangha up and we assign a different group of suttas for each Sangha to recite. Okay, fair enough. And it seems that what they would do is they'd have like one monastery that might specialize in the Digha, one monastery that might specialize in the Majjhima, perhaps not a monastery, perhaps like a teacher or a circle of students, something like that. But within that circle of students, not everybody would memorize that whole collection, right? Because it's still quite big, right? It's still, you know, the whole thing. So they would have like a list of essential suttas. So they'd have like a basic list of a curriculum that everyone would learn, much like you do today in the monastery, like everyone learns, you know, the basic chanting and things like that. And then once you did that, then you might be assigned, you know, a particular section, a few chapters and things like that. And then perhaps the more advanced students might learn the whole thing. And those, you know, a few would then go on to learn more than one Nikaya and perhaps learn then the whole Tripitaka or something like that. So there'd always be a few people who would know the whole thing, rather more who would know like one Nikaya, and most of the monks and nuns would know at least some of them. Okay, so that's how that system worked. So that's fine in terms of memorizing, but it raises a bit of a problem, which is that once you split these collections into all of these different parts, okay, right, you run the risk of creating four different religions, right? Because you've got four different sets of teachings. And the guys who are reciting the Anguttara can say, oh no, it's like this, because we've got a sutra that says like that, and you can have a whole school of interpretation based on that. And then the guys from the Majjhima are saying, oh no, hang on, it's like this, because we've got a sutra that says like this. And the amount of monks who actually knew all of those things, right? And I need to mention, not just to be politically correct, but also the amount of nuns to be mentioned, because in the inscriptions that talk about these things, which there's quite a lot of, it mentions nuns just as much as it does monks. Okay, so it mentions nuns who were memorizers of the Tripitaka, who were memorizers of the Nikaya and things like that. So they were there and they were playing their part just as often as the monks were. But anyway, so we have that potential problem. So how the Sangha resolve that problem is by, as well as separating and differentiating the Nikayas, but they also made sure that the core curriculum of Dhamma teachings was found in each of the Nikayas, or each of the arguments, okay? So in each one you find the teachings on the Four Noble Truths, in each one you find the Eightfold Path, in each one you find dependent origination, and so on and so forth, okay? And so in some cases, what that meant was that certain texts, especially in the case of the Digha Nikaya, that certain texts were more or less artificially constructed in order to make that possible, okay? So this is what's happened with the Satipatthana Sutra in the Digha Nikaya, is that because there's nowhere else in the Digha Nikaya that teaches about the Four Noble Truths in detail, right? It just mentions them in passing, right? It assumes you know what the Four Noble Truths are, okay? Right? But it doesn't actually teach them in detail. So they took the section from the Satyavibhanga Sutra in the Majjhima Nikaya, dealing with the Four Noble Truths in detail, and they stick that in the Satipatthana Sutra and the Dhammanupassana, because it was kind of flexible enough that you can kind of slot it in there. And see, the same thing happens in a number of other sutras in the Digha Nikaya, especially in the last two sutras, Sangiti Sutra and Dasutra Sutra, which more or less are nothing other than a collection of teachings which are more or less cut and pasted from elsewhere in the canon and put into these big sort of long lists of doctrinal categories and teachings and so on. So this is how these texts end up like that. And so when you look at it like that, you realize, oh, it's quite reasonable. That's why they created that text for the Digha Nikaya, and that's why we have two versions of the Satipatthana Sutta, and one of them is longer and one of them is shorter. It makes sense. However, in modern times, and I'm not exactly sure when, but I think it may have been in the time of the Fifth Council in Burma, when was the Fifth Council? Late 19th century in Burma, mid-19th century in Burma. The Burmese tradition decided to include the entire text of the Digha Nikaya in the Majjhima Nikaya, right? Thus creating a rather kind of strange situation where the Majjhima Nikaya discourse is actually longer than almost all the discourses in the Digha Nikaya, right? It's kind of crazy. And rather than having two versions of the sutta appropriate for the different collections, they now have one version of the sutta. And in that respect, the Burmese tradition is quite different from the Thai or the Sinhala traditions, which retain the more original form, where the Majjhima Nikaya, where the Satipatthana Sutta from the Majjhima Nikaya, is quite a lot shorter. The expanded material is all of that long explanation of the Four Noble Truths. So in the short version, which really belongs in the Majjhima Nikaya, it just mentions the Four Noble Truths in brief. And then all of that detailed explanation of it, so pretty much the material from where are we looking at? And it goes down, it actually marks it in the text. If you look at the section on the truths, section 4.5, and then it has a little mark there saying the first recitation section is finished, and that's actually the end of the main section of text in the Majjhima Nikaya version, and all the rest of it is then pasted in there. And then it just finishes off with the bit right at the end with the usual refrain and the ending of the sutta. So all of those pages in between, which is quite a lot of material, right, has been more or less cut and pasted from the Digha Nikaya and included in there. So, yeah, as I said, I feel somewhat conflicted about including that. I certainly don't believe that it belongs there. And yet that's the received text that we have. So that's just giving you a little bit about the background, the historical background to the creation of this particular text. Anyone have any questions on that? Yeah.
Well,
it's a good point, because with the creation of the long discourse in the Digha, you can see there's actually a clear, kind of rational, sensible reason for doing it, right? With this one, there doesn't seem to be such a reason. You're not preserving any extra texts, right? I mean, it's been a written tradition for a long time. That tradition of having different reciters and dividing it up, that's faded into the past long ago. The Majjhima Nikaya already has an extended treatment of the Four Noble Truths in the Satya Vibhanga Sutta. You're not really adding anything to the Majjhima Nikaya. So why is that happening? My best guess is that it was under the influence of the growing school of the Vipassana tradition, that they actually wanted to emphasize and sort of enhance the importance of their own interpretation and meditation by making the Satipatthana Sutta, which is their chief text, to be even bigger than it was. Remember at the Sixth Council that it was Mahasi Sayadaw, who essentially founded the Vipassana tradition, who was the main reciter. Right? I mean, so it's quite if it's true, it's quite scurrilous, right? I mean, to say that you changed the Pali canon in order to bolster up your own particular meditation path, it's scandalous if it's happened, right? And I've tried to sort of raise this issue a number of times, and most people don't seem to be interested in it. One problem, though, is that it is referenced in the Pali Text Society version, which was printed long before the Sixth Council, which is the council at which Mahasi Sayadaw was presiding, okay? And they reference a Burmese text that has that extra section in there. So it clearly wasn't invented at the Sixth Council. It must have come before that. And this is why I suspect it may have been at the Fifth Council. There's actually a project going on through Sydney Uni to help to digitize the engraved. The Fifth Council edition was actually carved in stone in Burma, and they were having a project to do that. So I was trying to see whether they could check the text of that to see whether that in fact did include the extra section or not, but we never managed to resolve that particular question. So far, anyway.
So this is at the same time that those other lines were put in the earlier parts of the sutra around rising, passing away.
No, that was much. So that's much different. That's all the same in both of those versions. Right. So all of the other changes would have happened, you know, like I said, at the latest, maybe 400 years after the Buddha.
Okay.
The reason I'm saying 400 years after the Buddha, 300 or 400 years, is quite late for the suttas. But the reason why I'm saying that is because the Pali version is quite significantly different from any of the versions we find in the other texts. And we know that the latest editions in the Digha Nikaya were made in Sri Lanka. Okay, we know that because the commentaries tell us that's what happened. So, given that this is one of the latest changes in the Digha Nikaya, I suspect it was probably made in Sri Lanka after the time of Ashoka, when the sutras were brought there.
Right, but those early changes were also used by the past commission.
Of course.
So, what was the agenda of those behind it? And you who made those earlier changes?
Yeah.
Well before.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Again, I look at that a little bit in the history of mindfulness. It's a bit difficult to kind of second guess people's motives. My feeling is that it's probably partly just more or less an accident, and partly, you know, that certain things were kind of emphasized and other people later on read those things as having a certain implication. It wasn't necessarily intended from the start.
It was magnified in the same sense.
Exactly, yeah. So it's probably partly accidental, but partly also, there was an interesting article written a number of years ago by Rupa Gethin, who's one of the English scholars of Buddhism. And he wrote this article where he argued was that, he said, the form of his argument was something like this. Modern scholars have criticized the Abhidhamma for introducing this theory of dhammas, which is alien to the teaching found in the suttas. Okay, and he said, but it's not really alien to the teaching found in the suttas, because here, if we look in the Pali Satipatthana Sutta and the Dhammanupassana, we find things that are very similar to the Abhidhamma. Therefore, the Abhidhamma was just drawing out things found in the suttas, right? So I wrote an article criticizing that and pointing out that, in fact, the section on dhammas in the Satipatthana Sutta must have been created very late and was probably under the influence of the Abhidhamma. So rather than the Abhidhamma drawing from it, it was drawing from the Abhidhamma. Yeah? I wrote to Rupert about that, and he's like, okay. And anyway, so it's, I think these things were formed together. Okay? One of the reasons for saying this is because we have a very, very unusual situation where the core passages in the suttas on the core teachings are quoted in an Abhidhamma text called the Vibhanga. Okay? And so all of the main teachings, the khandhas, six senses, dependent origination, so on and so forth, all the basic passages on these are quoted in the Abhidhamma Vibhanga, which then gives a comment and analysis and so on of those texts. Now, in the case of the Satipatthana, and Satipatthana alone, the passage in the Vibhanga is substantially simpler than the passage found in the sutta. Right? Everywhere else, it's just word for word what you find in the sutta. But in that particular one, it's a lot simpler. It only has the hindrances and awakening factors, right, under Dhamma Nipassana. Mm-hmm. It only has the 32 parts of the body under body contemplation. Mm-hmm. It's a lot simpler and a lot shorter, right? Now, if you're familiar with the Abhidhamma, you'll know that simplicity and brevity are not two of its strong points, okay? So it was certainly not abbreviating these things because it was running out of space, okay? And so, you know, it's one of my arguments is it's not just the Abhidhamma, but also the concordance of all of the sutta versions of it and many other things, which seem to suggest actually that Abhidhamma version is very close to the original text. And so that there was, to me, there was like a kind of a two-way thing going where that text was partly formed under the influence of the Abhidhamma in a very similar way to kind of authenticate their own teachings by showing that they were part of what's in the canon, in the suttas. Yeah. See, remember, for the early generation of the Abhidhammas, they didn't consider their texts canonical. Right? They knew that they were just writing these texts or composing them. Right? They knew they weren't the suttas. Yeah? So in the Abhidhamma itself, when it argues about authenticity, it never argues about authenticity, it never says, this teaching must be true because it says so in the Abhidhamma. Right? It discusses hundreds of doctrinal points and always says this must be true because it says so in the suttas. Right? So the Abhidhamma doesn't consider itself to be canonical. Right? So they were still seeking for authority, seeking to justify their own particular interpretation of the Dhamma, right, by showing that it was found in the suttas. Yeah. Well, we could all make our own version. That would be good. That would make things much simpler. Well, yeah, I already did that in my book, in the History of Mindfulness. I did a translation of the original text. Look, I have thought of that. We probably could put a just like a tag on this particular passage and say that it seems to have been added by later redactors. But I mean, that's not a bad thing to do. But the problem is, of course, where do you stop? I mean, there's stacks of other things I could point to and say, well, look, I think this is a later edition. I'll get right to that, okay? We'll see if we can get it sorted by breakfast time tomorrow. See if I've read, there's just too many damn sutras. See, the problem is with this kind of thing is that there are a few cases, like this case, where you can be fairly confident this is what's going on, right? But then there are many other cases where it's much less certain, and it really comes down to very subjective opinion. So this is why, we don't really get... You know, it's better for these things to be in a secondary literature rather than in the primary literature. Having said which, somebody did actually edit up a version, because when I did my book on History of Mindfulness, I did like a translated version of the original text. And subsequent to that, somebody did a Pali version of the same thing, so they essentially created the original Pali text. So that does exist around somewhere. I can't remember exactly where it's found now. Yeah, so someone's done that. But we, you know, when we're doing Sutta Central, we just have to be true to what we're doing. Actually, I prefer to use a text which was based on the Sinhalese manuscripts. The Sinhalese manuscripts are, on the whole, more authentic. But there just isn't a good digital edition that's based on those. If there was, we'd probably use that instead. This is the problem. It's just a practical problem. Yeah. Okay. We need to sort of add as a caveat, it only really is relevant in a very small number of cases. Excuse me one second, this is tangled. We will look in brief at these different sections, starting with the section on the aggregates. And as I mentioned before, each of these sections is found very commonly throughout the suttas. So furthermore, a monastic meditates by observing an aspect of the principles in respect to the five aggregates. Here, a monastic understands such as form, such as the origin of form, such as the ending of form, such as feeling, such as the origin of feeling, the ending of feeling, such as perception, such as the origin and the ending of perception, such as choices, the origin of choices and the ending of choices, such as consciousness, the origin of consciousness and the ending of consciousness. And as before, they meditate internally, externally, on origination, dissolution, and so on. Okay, so this is one of the standard passages we see on the five aggregates. So I'll just give a little bit of background on these. I'm sure most of you have probably heard of the five aggregates beforehand. The Pali phrase we translate as aggregate is khandha, which is like a branch or a stem or a mass of something. I don't think anybody actually likes the word aggregate, but we haven't thought of anything better. Anyone's got any suggestions? By clusters, groups, categories, not sure. Sometimes section works for a khanda. Anyway, the point being that within these, what we have is like a category or a class of things. So there's a bunch of things which are similar, which are all being classed together under these khandas. Now, one thing to bear in mind with these khandas is that the suttas do not take the five aggregates to be a comprehensive classification of everything that exists. Okay? The suttas never try to do that with the aggregates. In fact, it's very telling that in the suttas, the word sabba, okay, sabba meaning all, is frequently associated with the six senses, but it's not associated with the five aggregates. Okay? Most of the teachings on the six senses and five aggregates are very similar, right? They're treated in very, very similar ways. Okay, there's hundreds of suttas that are basically identical, except one is classified for the other. You see them as impermanent and all of this kind of thing. But one striking difference is that the six senses are seen as being sabba because the six senses encompass the entirety of experience. Okay, and that same use of the word sabba is not found in the context of the five aggregates. Why? Because they don't encompass the whole of experience, and we shouldn't try to make them do that. The tendency to think that everything belongs in the khandhas somewhere or other is a tendency which emerged in the Abhidhamma period. The five khandhas are not a comprehensive classification of all the things in the world. They are a classification of the kinds of theories of self. Okay, they are the things which we most commonly tend to attach to and claim as a self, and in particular, they are the things which were used as the basis for theorizing about the self by the philosophies and schools in ancient India. So when we look in something like the Brahmajala Sutta, which classifies the theory of the self in very kind of elaborate ways, then it frequently will say things like rupi atta, right? Myself has form. Okay? Or sanyi atta, myself is percipient. Or ekanta sukha patisamvedi atta, myself experiences only pleasant feelings. and so on and so forth. So there is these different classifications of self which neatly correlate with these five aggregates, right? So that's what these things are. They are the things in our experience which we tend to attach to as a self, we tend to identify with, and which we tend to build our theories of the self around, okay? So this teaching of the five aggregates is closely associated with the teaching of not self, right? Now, I'll just briefly mention what each of these five is. Many of them we've discussed already, so I won't dwell on it for too long. So the first one is rupa, is the form, and that consists of the entire physical world, both one's own body. Sometimes rupa means specifically your own body, but it also means the physical world as perceived, right? So sight, sound, smells, tastes, and touch. It also means your mental perception of physical qualities, okay? So if you're sitting in meditation and you see a light with your mind's eye, that also is a rupa, okay? Even though there's no light outside, there's no physical thing that corresponds to it, it's a rupa. And so this is why rupa is actually quite a hard word to translate. And I loathe and detest the translation form, which I've used here. And I have many, many times said this is ridiculous, it's a terrible translation, nobody should use it, and now I'm using it. Because I can't think of a better one. And I had some discussion about this with Jason when we met a couple of weeks ago, and it's like, can you translate it as physical phenomena, right? In many ways, yes, physical phenomena doesn't work too badly, but it doesn't capture that inner essence of the idea of rupa. Another way of thinking about rupa, which you can sometimes use to translate it, is appearance. Okay? Appearance. Right? Rupa is how the physical properties, the physical world appears to us, how it presents to us, which actually is similar to the root meaning of the word phenomena. Right? A phenomena is actually based on a Greek root meaning something like to show or display. Right, so a phenomena is an appearance of things, right? And rupa actually is used in that way quite a lot, right? A rupa is often like your physical appearance in the way we translate it. So that's another word that we could use to translate rupa, but again, that kind of falls down in some context. So it's not an easy one to translate, but basically that's the idea. So it's talking about all the physical phenomena, both the we've mentioned before the word upadina, the grasp that material form, right? So this is the organic form which is produced when you get born, and that's the internal rupa, and also the external rupa, which is the world as we perceive it through our senses, and it also includes what we call the sukuma rupa, the subtle form which is perceived directly by the mind. Okay?
The
awakening factor, for example, and experience, is that rupa? No, the awakening factor is a mental quality, but it will have some correlation, which might be rupa. Right? So these things are never completely separate, right? So it's always reflected.
So would it be true to say that rupa is anything that's manifest?
No, it's any physical quality or property that's manifest. Okay, so light is a physical quality, but pleasure is not.
Yes, that's what I was getting at, the question around the awakening factor, is that. So pleasure is not then, not form or not rupa, then that would have to be true of all awakening factors as well.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
So when you first answered, you said it has a correlate with...
They're interconnected. Yeah? So just as when you meditate, you make your mind peaceful and your body also becomes peaceful. So the rupa is changed, right? It's the same thing in deep meditation. When your mind becomes more peaceful, the rupa, the perception of say, your samadhi nimitta, that's why it's called rupa jhana. Right? We have this phrase rupa jhana. Why is it rupa jhana? Because it's based on this sukhma rupa, this perception of light. Yeah, subtle form. Yeah. This is why it's a difficult concept to capture, because we don't really have a word in English that approaches the material world in that way at all, right? I mean, you don't even have, interestingly enough, you don't even have a word in English that means the entire objective physical realm. I mean, you have the word matter, but matter doesn't include energy, right? You don't have a word in English really that includes matter and energy.
Phenomena.
A phenomena can also be mental phenomena, yeah? You could say something like physical phenomena or materiality or physicality, okay, fine, but you don't have like an ordinary, everyday English word that straightforwardly refers to the whole physical realm. Sukhama means subtle. Yeah, so in this case it means that the form as it's perceived only by the mind.
So if you saw a light around somebody's head, or body, or form, or your own, that would be...
That would be a kind of rupa, yeah? Sukhama rupa, yeah, that you're seeing with your mano, with your mind, rather than seeing with your eyes. That's right, and sometimes, of course, it can be hard to distinguish. Right? I mean, sometimes it might be just a hallucination.
Yeah.
Again, right, a hallucination is produced entirely by your mind. There's nothing physical to there, but it has all those qualities of physicality. It has colour, it has location, and so on. Right? So this is, again, is considered a rupa, because rupa is not based on what is... See, the thing is, it's not based on the underlying ontological nature of it, right? We think of matter as being something that's made up of particles, right? That's not the point. The point is what appears with those properties. So if something appears with the properties of colour, then it's a rupa, regardless of whether there's actual light that's conveying that colour. Yeah, so it's actually the physical appearance of those properties. Yeah. Sorry, you had a question earlier. The Sada Rupa is being... I'm not quite sure what you're referring to as Prasada Rupa. No, I think the Prasada Rupas are it's an Abhidhamma term for the sensitive basis for sense consciousness. So you have like the sensitive surface in the eyes, which is the basis, yeah. So I'm not quite sure how the Abhidhamma classifies that, but no, I wouldn't have thought that that would be regarded as Sukhama Rupa. But yeah, you'd have to look. It's an Abhidhamma concept. I'm not quite sure how they treat it. Yeah. Normally, my understanding is that Sukhama Rupa is solely those things that are perceived by the mind. Yeah, so Larika Rupa is this stuff. Yeah. Yep. Okay. Sorry, Ken. All right, excellent. Very good. Yes. Yes.
So you said that aggregate theory, comprehensive theory thing.
Yeah.
That's everything that's transcribed by the form of cover.
Yes, that's true. You could say that form covers the entire material world, as you see, but it doesn't. The five aggregates don't include the entire mental realm. Which is what we'll come on to in a minute. Stats of things. We'll come on and we'll see what it does cover in a second. Yeah? Okay. So, again, just hustling a little bit, because we want to get through stuff. Okay. Feeling. Next one. We've already talked about feeling in some length, so let's move on. Next one, perception. We've also discussed perception in somewhat less length, but I think perception is the quality of the mind that recognizes things. Essentially what perception does is it summarizes, all right? Perception summarizes, it abstracts, okay? It's like the executive summary of experience, right? Because it's too much data to make sense of it, right? They're making in WA now, they're building the world's biggest, it's like they're supposed to be the biggest science project of the next 20 years and the biggest radio telescope ever. And they're building it, it's like what they call it. There's no computer that can actually compute the data that it's going to be producing. Okay? Right, so this thing that they're building on and they're putting it online out in the middle of this remote desert, and like you're not allowed to go within 100 miles of it with a mobile phone or something like that. Okay, and no computer exists that can process the data. Yeah? So they're entirely reliant on Moore's law to be able to, by the time it's online and finished, there'll probably be a computer that can do it. But at the moment, there isn't, right? Mm-hmm. That's an example to show us how much information, right, we're coming through our senses, right? And we've got to compute all of that data, right? You've got to make sense of all of the stuff that's being handled through your senses. And so what our senses do is they perception interprets it, recognizes patterns, and it presents to us the data in an interpreted form which it thinks is going to be useful for us. Okay, and when I say it thinks it's going to be useful for us, what that means is that it's conditioned by past experience. Okay, so that's how perception works. It learns from past experience. You know, think about the very basic things like this is food, this is not food, right? And one example which I always mention is the example, you know, think about like how a caveman is developing their perception, right? They're sitting around their cave fire in the night time and they hear a noise in the bush. Okay? So that noise in the bush is either a deer, in which case they have dinner, or it's a tiger, in which case they are dinner. Right? And so if you've lived in the bush and in the jungle for a long time, you'll know that your perception gets very, very finely attuned to these things. Okay? And all you will hear is one footstep on one twig, okay? And you will know with a very high degree of certainty whether that's a deer or a tiger, okay? You will just know, right? I've been in this situation, you hear just a tiny noise and you know exactly what that animal is. I mean, I've only, you know, haven't lived in the forest my whole life, but I know that if you're, that's what people have said with, like, if you're walking through the bush with indigenous people and things like that, people that really know the bush, you know, they'd be like, oh yeah, there's 20 kangaroos feeding over there, or whatever. You learn to pick up these things, which are just so at such a subtle level, and that's your training, your perception. And so perception is actually an essential tool for our minds to work properly, right? You can imagine if every moment we're just getting this mass of raw data dumped into our consciousness, and you have to make sense of it, right? I mean, it's completely impossible. So this is a perception, that's how it works. But of course the problem is, because we're interpreting things based on past experience, you sometimes make mistakes. It's like how your spam filter works, right? In your email, right? It analyzes emails on the basis of what it thinks spam is going to look like, and most of the time it works, but sometimes it'll send something to spam when it doesn't belong there, sometimes it'll allow something through that it shouldn't. Right? So perception is never 100%, but it's still extremely useful. Now, one of the things that perception does, again to come back to the basic function of perception, is it clumps things together. Okay? It categorizes things, it abstracts things out. Okay, so it tends to see things as a whole. It takes a disparity and it makes a wholeness out of them. And one of the things which is very defining in human culture is that what culture is the conscious training of our perception in order to create wholeness. Okay, so rather than wholeness being something which perhaps in the animal realm is much more instinct driven, right? You know, and you have like small groups which will live together and so on, and you know, according to their genetics and whatever they have. But we consciously shape the forms of societies that we have by using perception, right? So you use colours, right? So some of the oldest signs of human culture is like where you paint things, right? You use colours, you use shapes, you use language. You have like a group identity. Mm-hmm. You can have an us and a them, right? And you can band together in larger groups, and of course get that strength and safety through numbers. And so through human society, what we've done is we've used flags and kings and buildings and all of these things, and we create symbols out of them, and those symbols bring people together. You know, these days we use it with football teams, right? Or whatever. And so again, that's what you're doing. You're training your perception to try to group certain kinds of things together. And again, this is something which it's essential. You couldn't have built our cultures without it. And yet at the same time, of course, it has a lot of drawbacks because you can end up over-identifying with those symbols, and you take that symbol to be something which is real and something which is more significant than it actually is. I'm saying that it's something where we kind of evolve beyond purely an instinctual way of doing things by consciously training ourselves.
So perception in a sense is what in creating what we call universals.
Yes. Yes.
Mm. Yeah. Or assumptions, maybe?
Assumptions, yeah.
There's a science called semiology. Would that be
relevant? Exactly. Yeah, the science of science. Yeah. How we do that. Exactly, yeah. So this is all in that kind of realm. And so perception is very closely associated with language, right? I mean, animals have perception too, right? It obviously functions at a much more basic level, but humans... This is the difference, I think, one of the main differences between the animal realm and the human realm is that humans consciously use this perception in order to shape their societies and so on. And obviously developing language is one of the most powerful tools of that. So perception and language are not the same thing, but they're very closely associated. Right? And so you can see once you think of perception as being that world of symbols and abstraction and ideas and so on and so forth, then that becomes something that we very strongly identify with. Right? We identify with I'm in this tradition, I'm in this family, I'm in this country, I'm in this religion and something like that. And so that becomes something we attach to as being part of ourselves. Okay, so this is what's going on here, and so we learn to reflect on that and understand it. One of the things that happens in meditation, and one of the reasons why we slow experience down, okay, is because you think of those of you who have an IT background or something, you think in terms of like degrees of compression, right? How much are you going to compress the data? Yeah. So we always have to compress the data to some degree. But the faster things happen, right, the more we have to compress all the data, right? And the less you can take things in, right? So when you're in a lot of flurry and things like that, you only notice a tiny amount of things. So when we're in meditation, and when we're on retreat, we slow everything down. We have less sense input, less thinking, less ideas, less stimulation, all of that slows down, so we don't have to compress our information so much, right? We actually just let it come in, and all of those things come, and those things which normally might be just too trivial for you to bother paying attention to, so it gets shunted into your spam folder, so to speak, right? But you can actually become conscious of it and become aware of it. So it's not that you go beyond perception. Perception is always there in consciousness. It's part of how consciousness works, okay? But it's like a thinner layer of perception, okay? It's working less, and you can see closer to what the kind of raw data of experience is happening. Okay, so perception. Next one is sankharas, which I've translated hopefully controversially as choices here. Sankharas are often translated as something like formations or something terrible like that. But when sankharas is defined, it's always defined in terms of chetana or intention. Okay, and chetana or intention is always defined or usually defined in a moral sense. Okay, so you have the phrase like punya visankara, apunya visankara, like good, which I would translate as good choices and bad choices. Okay, so a Bhikkhu Bodhi has meritorious volitional formations and demeritorious volitional formations, which to me is like a classic of Buddhist hybrid English. But what I actually mean is you make good choices and you make bad choices. Okay, and this is what sankharas really is about. Okay, now sankharas is the classic place where everything that doesn't fit in everywhere else gets lumped. Okay, so in the Abhidhamma period, they basically took every kind of mental quality that the Buddha mentioned, faith, attention, joy, on and on and on and on and on, listed about 50 or so things, and said, oh, they don't fit anywhere else in the khandhas, so we're going to dump them into sankharas, okay? So that means, you know, the khandhas are like rupa, vedana, sannyas, sankhara, and vijnana. And the whole kind of structure of it is lost, and the whole understanding of the original purpose of it is lost, right? Because many of those things are not things that we tend to identify as self, okay? So you think like a mental quality like, say, attention, okay? Attention, the quality of mind that turns towards something, that wants to turn towards. That's not something that you typically think of as yourself, right? I'm my attention, right? You don't think that. I imagine that I'm going to be reborn in a heaven realm where I attend to things, okay? I mean, that's not something you attach to as yourself. You do think, I'm going to be reborn in a heaven realm where I'm going to be blissful and experience happy feelings, right? Ah, that's something you can identify with. But so there are many of these different kinds of mental qualities. It's not that you completely never identify with them, right? It's just that they don't tend to be the main things that most people identify as their self, okay? But one thing that people really do identify as their self is choice. Right? Choices are very, very important in how we define ourselves, okay? When you go into the supermarket, right? You go and you say, am I going to buy this soup or that soup, okay? Right? And that defines your choices, who you are. And you buy your soup and you bring it home and somebody says, oh, that soup's rubbish, right? And then you think, oh, you know, they criticize me. I mean, that's a very trivial example, but I think you all know what I mean. Mm-hmm. Where the clothes that we buy, the cars that we drive, the software that we use, the coffee shops that we like to go and drink at, all of these kinds of things are innocuous choices in one way, but they all add up, right, through that series of choices to define who we are, right? And you can see, I hope, that in this series of the aggregates or the khandhas, there's like an evolution or a growth. We can see it in terms of, say, the growth of an individual through the life, that when you're born initially, first conceived and so on, essentially there's just rupa, there's just the physical, and gradually the mental qualities start emerging. The first thing you see, babies, they have a lot of feelings, right? They don't have a lot in terms of, like, you know, theorizing, okay? But they do have a lot. They cry and they're happy and these things. So they have their know is predominant. Not to say the other things are absent, but that feeling, that way to know, is predominant at that stage. And then as they grow up, they learn how to recognize things, they learn mummy and daddy, they learn language, right? They learn to identify. So they're developing their sannya, okay? And this is part of growing up. Then as they especially hit adolescent years, then they learn to make choices, right? They learn what's right and what's wrong, okay? And, you know, this is what we consider to be adulthood, is the ability to make your own choices and to take responsibility for those choices. And of course, it's not something that just happens at one point. You keep on developing these things through your life. But prominently, that's really when we begin to start and we say, okay, you know, you can vote, right? You can join the army. You can get a job, yeah? You can get married, right? So this is that choice.
Right. I think teenagers are particularly fashion, music,
That's where they want to make choices at. Fashion, music, and friends. But that's what rebelling is, right? Rebelling is, I can make a choice which is different from what my parents made. Yeah? That's all it is. You know, it might not seem quite like that when you're being rebelled against, but actually that's what's happening. Sorry? It's like a story. You're building up that kind of story, and that's how we construct our sense of self. Yeah. I always remember when George W. Bush was in power, and you know, everybody used to think, oh, he's just basically Ron Silver and Cheney, and those guys are running the show, and he's just the mouthpiece, right? It was never entirely convincing to me, because if I was going to choose a mouthpiece, I'd choose one that could actually speak properly. But in any case, you know, you could see he he would say things like, I remember one phrase he said, I am the decider. I am the decider. You know, what's going on there? You know, he's the president of the United States, right? Does he feel the need to assert his power like that? I am the decider, right? So there's obviously this kind of insecurity because he knows that people think that everyone else is making the decisions, right? But that's where he is identifying with. He's the one who makes the decision. Right? Again, so this is where that Sankara is, that choice.
I used the word sanya. Does that mean self?
Sanya is deception.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep. Sorry, I sit between Pali and English sometimes.
Personally, speaking, this choice by the outcome, talking about the mental quality, choosing the more in line with the mental.
Choosing rather than choice?
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Choices, preferences. I'm still not entirely. Yeah, I did think of that actually. I'm not entirely settled on. Let's see how we go. Even something like making choices, perhaps. Sorry, I did you have your hand up earlier?
Making choices directly in relation to deception. Is it a reaction?
Well, that's right. This is one of the things.
I
mean, and you know, you think about that in terms of what I said before, like perception is like an executive summary, right? So you've got everyone who's down there on the field doing all of the work, right? And then they do like a one-page summary, and then they give it to the boss, and then the boss makes a decision. Yeah? And why does the boss do that? Well, because they haven't got time to look at all of the data, right? So they just have to trust that they're getting the summary. Yeah.
Just one comment on it. Does it mean if you less choices mean that it's better?
Less choices are better. Well, choices are suffering. Yeah? Having to make choices is stressful, but it also gives you confidence, right? So it's not a one-way street, you know? Actually becoming a mature adult means being able to make choices. Yeah. And giving up the ability to make choices is not a sign of maturity. You know, you have to take responsibility for your choices. And, you know, wisdom is that which allows you to make good choices. But it also understands that you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know what the outcome is, but you have to do something anyway. You have to make a choice anyway.
Actually, I think they find even a proportion of depression, or severe depression, is when you can't make a choice, you can't even decide whether to get out of bed, whether to stand or not.
Right.
You know,
right.
Sort of daily living.
Yeah.
So that can be as a function.
Right? Absolutely. Yeah.
So the people are the same thing.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
They're finding, you know, under five, they're stressed. They've been given too many choices.
Yeah.
Probably due to that, probably the way today.
Yeah, you can get supplements for them in the health groups.
Nice.
Calm the children down.
Yeah, nice.
But it's hard to go with parents that are giving too many choices to children inappropriately.
Yeah, that's right. Choice is stress, definitely. Yeah, so
the parents are abrogating their choice.
They did a test with rats on this some time ago, and I don't endorse this, and I don't think this is ethically appropriate. But anyway, what you do is you get some food, and you get a rat, and you get an electric grid. Doesn't have to be a very powerful one, just a bit of a zap on the rat's feet. So anyway, so the rat or the mouse sees the food and goes and eats them. Now what they found was that if they keep the electricity on, okay, the rat will go and will put its foot on there and get zapped and then come back and then try it a few times. And after a while it will get hungry enough so it will go and get the food. Okay? And once it's figured that out, then it'll go and get food whenever it gets hungry. But if you randomly turn the electricity grid on and off, yeah, the rat is much less likely to want to go and grab the food. Right? I mean, it seems counterintuitive because it's actually got 50% greater chance of not getting zapped, right? But the point is that it's uncertain, right? And so the rat has to make a decision in that uncertain situation, and that's more stressful. Yeah.
They also
stop
it and the same choice but in conscious, because if two people are playing, as soon as one takes the ball, the other one wants to take the ball. And the quantity is more of the same form rather than the
control.
So that means the choices are less disturbed because if people feel things or they don't want to
So if you turn about self into life, what choice do you make into life? That way you sort of you edge yourself along with yourself.
Yeah, no, you don't. You're not making choices in samadhi. You've made the choice
with
previous conditions. The choice is kind of suspended there. I mean, it's kind of, you know, choice is not something that happens all the time anyway, right? I mean, it happens from time to time. But in a state like samadhi or something like that, it's, you can think of it as being suspended, or you can think of it as simply being sustained. You know, like you've set your intention long beforehand when you're doing your meditation and through that long period of meditation, so that you're not like making choices in samadhi, but your the direction of your mind is already set. Yeah, you've got the momentum. So I'd like to move along a little bit. So we talked about that choice, and we talked about the thing of evolution. Now, again, in Western culture, that's as far as it goes, okay? So it's the ability to think and reason and make choices is the kind of the highest thing, right? And that's what a great philosopher or something is, somebody who's able to do those things. But of course, in the Eastern traditions, they paid attention to vijnana, to consciousness, and that's always regarded as something which is higher. It's a greater stage of evolution, and something which is acknowledged by some psychologists. Abraham Maslow, very kind of famously, later on in his life, added sort of another stage of development, which I think he called self-actualization or something like that. So that brings some kind of the wisdom stage into development. So from a Buddhist point of view, so consciousness is that which in a way sort of sits at the center of all of the other experiences and makes all of those other experiences happen. Interestingly enough, in the early Buddhist texts, you don't have any phrase that means something like mind and body. Okay, the Buddha didn't divide things up dualistically. He didn't talk about there being a mind and a body. And if there is a fundamental distinction, the fundamental distinction is made between those four other khandhas and consciousness. Okay? That's the primary distinction that's made here. And the Buddha says that these four other khandhas all lean up against consciousness. They lean up against vijnana. They depend on vijnana. So it's with all of these other things that works. And this is why the word for khanda is upadana khanda. Right? The word upadana is grasping. Right? The Buddha rarely uses the word khanda to talk about these things. Almost always he uses upadana khanda, grasping khandas. That's why there are five of them, because they grasp. Yeah? And it's consciousness that enables all of those other things to come together. Right? So it's the panchupadana khanda, the five khandas of grasping, which are pancha, means you can punch things with them. It's true, that's where the word punch comes from. It's from pancha, right? As in five.
You think I'm making this stuff up?
Yeah. So I talked quite a bit about the vinyana and so on, especially in the contemplation of mind. So again, I won't dwell on that too much here, but just if there are any questions on that before we move on. Sorry? Because it's grasping, it's still cut short, yeah. That's right, yeah. But the other interesting implication of that is that because it's the five khandhas, it's like grasping only happens with all of those khandhas together. That's what those khandhas do, is they grasp things.
Yeah. How much do you think the aggregates set up in anti-dragon fiction to the compared to
that? Very much so. Yeah, very much so. I think that the five khandhas was specifically, I think originally, like if you look, it seems like the five khandhas were sort of widely known among the ascetics in the time of the Buddha, right? There's a number of places, obviously, even in the Dhammacakka or in the Anathalagana Sutta, in the Buddha's first teaching to the group of five ascetics, he doesn't try to explain what five aggregates are, he just assumes that they know what they are. And there's a lot of other places where that's the same thing, I think in like the Satchaka Suttas and things like that as well. And the various ascetics seem to, you know, take it for granted that people know what these things are. So it seems that it was a system or a way of categorizing self-theories, okay? Which itself shows that that kind of philosophical society had reached, you know, it was quite sophisticated, right? You didn't just have theories of self, but you had systems of classifications of theories of self, right? So it had obviously reached quite an advanced stage, and we know from the Upanishads, you know, the Upanishads themselves have multiple different theories of the Atman. They don't like have one theory. I mean, we talk about the Upanishadic idea of the little self being the cosmic Atman and so on, and that's, you know, the most poignant and profound and characteristic definition of self in the Upanishad, but there's plenty of others there, and in the Jainas as well, they had their own theory of self, which is quite distinct, the idea of a jiva, and of course there are multiple other schools of philosophy who may be referred to here and there, or perhaps we don't even know anything about them. You know, if you look in the Brahmajala Sutta, it's not certain that all of those views represented there were practiced by actual, you know, groups. We're not sure, is it just a theoretical listing of views or is it actual ones? But certainly many of them were. There has to be a way to kind of make sense of that, and you say, you know, find out where in that scheme does your own particular teaching reside. And particularly the teaching on vijnana as not self, is clearly meant as directly an attack on the Brahmanical notion. Okay, I mean, you know, if you look at the basic phrases in the Anathalagana Sutta, Neham Mama Neso Hamasmi Nameso Atati, this is a direct contradiction to phrases you find in the Upanishads, right? Neham Mama Neso Hamasmi, Neso Hamasmi is I am not that. Right? I mean, it's a direct opposite of the Tadvangasi, which is found in the Upanishads by Ajnavalkya. So it's clearly these things are meant as a direct rebuttal of those things. Yeah.
So the only theory of being would be like dependent arising, independent perception.
Sorry?
The only sort of theory of being, sort of existence, would be dependent origination and dependent perception. How things come to be and how things
fit. I'm not quite sure the point of the question.
I always thought like the aggregates was like
a
theory of being.
I don't think the Buddha was interested in a theory of being. You know, I mean, even dependent origination is pointing to specifically pragmatic things that can help us to understand the nature of suffering and to let go of it. So, I mean, there's obviously a relation to theories of being, but you know, you can see, you know, one thing that's very, very, very striking in the early Abhidhamma, canonical Abhidhamma, right? It lists a bunch of dhammas and then says yeva pananya, or yeva pananya, right? And whatever else. See, this is one of the most important phrases in the Abhidhamma, right? It says there's this, when this happens, this is present, this is present, this is present, this is present, and whatever else is present. right? So it's not trying to make an exhaustive list of all of the things that are present. And then in the commentaries, it says, well, when it says ye wa pananye, it means this, and then it gives a list of them. So this is kind of, the system is evolving and it's moving towards being able to say, you know, we've got like a complete list of all the things that there are, okay? And we can sort of wrap it up and say existence is this. But I don't think that's what the suttas were trying to do at all. That, in fact, is clearly not what the suttas are trying to do. Yeah. Okay. Moving on. Okay, khandhas, finished. Next. Okay, we've been going for more than an hour. Do you want to maybe have 5 minutes, have a bit of a break for Shalit and stuff? Can it be at 9:30? Okay, let's have a break at 9:30. Moving along. Svalayatana. I've translated as sense fields rather than sense spaces. Word sense field seems to me to make quite a lot of sense. Pun intended. And the literal meaning of ayatana is actually much closer to field. And ayatana is like an extension or a stretching out of things. Okay, so it's very close in meaning to like a field. So here Manasi clearly knows the eye, knows the sights, knows the fetter that arises dependent on both of these. Okay? So again, this is something that we can use in our meditation, right? So you, when you meditate, you contemplate, you become aware of your eye, you become aware that your eye, that the stimulus of the eye, and then you're aware of the attachment, right? You clearly know how the fetter that has not arisen comes to arise, how the arisen fetter comes to be abandoned, and how the abandoned fetter comes to not arise again in the future. And so here you see that the phrasing is obviously very similar to what we've seen before in the context of the five aggregates and the seven awakening factors. But here applied to this category, which is not so much a practice category, but a category of investigating phenomena of experience. Similarly with ear and sounds, nose and smells, tongue and tastes, body and touches, mind and mental phenomena, you understand all of these things, you understand the fetter that arises dependent on them, how the fetter that has not arisen comes to arise, and how the arisen fetter comes to be abandoned, and how the abandoned fetter comes to not arise again in the future. So this is that practice of investigating the six senses. So from a Buddhist point of view, our experience, our world, our loka, the world, or the sabba, the all, is the six senses and their object, right? So it's the world as we experience, right? So remember that in Buddhism, our description of experience is always from a subjective point of view, okay? And so this is not to say that the Buddha was an idealist. It wasn't to say that he believed that there is no external world, okay? It's a methodological issue. It's not an ontological issue. The Buddha wasn't about saying this exists in the world and this doesn't exist in the world. He was about saying this is why we suffer and this is how we get out of suffering. And suffering is something that arises subjectively, okay? That's why the Buddha's teaching is always presented from a subjective purpose, because it's in line with that pragmatic program that the Buddha was talking about. And so it's very easy to overinterpret what the Buddha was saying. This is something that happens very commonly in the Buddhist tradition. So rather than seeing the teaching as being something which is there to help us to let go of our suffering, it becomes something which is supposedly some sort of complete scientific description of the world or something like that. That's not what it was meant to be. So with these six senses, this is the all. This is all that we experience. Everything that we ever experience comes to us through these six senses. Of course, many of you have probably seen the movie, The Sixth Sense, but the sixth sense in Buddhism is not knowing who's dead and alive and all these kinds of things, but it's about it's simply the mind, okay? Which can, of course, include those other six senses, right? Those other kinds of sensory things. Anyway, whatever. Okay? But normally, the sixth sense is just the mind. And the mind here, it's somewhat, how can I put this? You see, each of these senses works in different ways. Like we have like a formula that describes them, but in fact they work in quite different ways. So like you have the eye and the sight, things like that. And so there's like quite a clear separation, yeah, between the eye and the things that you see. But for example, consider the body sense, right? Your internal body sense. It's not so clear that there's a separation between the actual physical body and the things that you experience, right? I mean, we experience things inside ourselves all the time. It's a kind of stimulus. It's a bit harder to tease out that difference. So remember that this is just like a structure that we're using to explain experience. And in the context of the mind, it becomes even harder to apply that structure, right? The mind is obviously much more complex, much more subtle, right? Much more nuanced than any of the other senses. But we have this framework which is at least giving us a handle on how we can begin to approach understanding our mind through experience and to be able to see the difference between that subjective mind, the mind that like sits in here and looks out, and that world of experience which is impinging and stimulating the mind. So, onwards. So we looked at the aggregates and sense fields, and so these are two of the sections which added, I believe, to this part of the Dhamma Vipassana. And then the final part which was added at this was the section on the Four Noble Truths. And if we've already looked at the factors of awakening which are next, and if we skip over a few pages to section 4.5, then we have the truths. And the beginning of the section here, monastic understands in accordance with reality, this is suffering, this is the origin of suffering, this is the cessation of suffering, and this is the practice that leads to the cessation of suffering. So this, of course, is just a very brief statement of the Four Noble Truths. And normally, as I mentioned before, normally in the Majjhima Nikaya version, that's all there is, right? So it just has a very brief statement. But in the Digha Nikaya version, then all of that detailed explanation of that is added. And that's what we're going to be looking at in just a minute. So, of course, the thing with the Four Noble Truths is that the Four Noble Truths are normally, they're the thing that everything else fits into, rather than being the thing which is fitted into everything else.
Mm.
Right? So this teaching on Satipatthana, mindfulness, in fact is the seventh factor of the Eightfold Path, which is the Fourth Noble Truth. Right? And so now we're seeing the Four Noble Truths coming within that, right? So it goes around. And of course this actually is one of the characteristics of the Dhamma, is that it has this kind of fractal quality. So what we mean when we say fractal quality is that the same patterns or self-same patterns are repeated with the same level of complexity and different scales. And so a classic example of a fractal pattern would be something like a shoreline. Right? So we can look at a shoreline and we can see, oh, there's the kind of the boundary between the ocean and the land. But when you kind of look closely, if you sort of put a camera like a meter above the ground, you know, you can see that there's an unevenness, there's a jagged edge there. And then if you put it like 10 meters above and analyze that, and you put it 100 meters and 1 kilometer and 10 kilometers and so on, at each level it's got a degree of roughness or I can't remember the term used there, degree of, like the shape has a certain level of erraticness, right? And statistically it'll be the same at each level, okay? So at each level we look at it, has the same type, kind of complexity. And you see the same, those kinds of fractal patterns are very commonly observed in nature and organic patterns, right? So when you look inside a cell, for example, you know, you see just as much complexity as you do by looking at the whole organism. So the Dhamma has that kind of quality where you can kind of zoom back and sort of have an overarching look at the whole of the Dhamma and say, you know, the whole Dhamma is in the Four Noble Truths, as we saw Venerable Sariputta did in the Mahāhatthivadhopama Sutta, you know, just like everything fits into the elephant's footprint, all the Dhamma can include in the Four Noble Truths. But then we can zoom in a lot closer and go and far and far and far and far and far and far and see, and then What do we see? Oh, we see the Four Noble Truths again. And you can sort of open that up, and that same thing is there, right? And that's because those truths, those basic principles of the Dhamma, those principles of the Dhamma are true everywhere. They're true. Impermanence is true of the cosmos. It's also true of a pentaquark. Okay. Pentaquark, incidentally, which was just discovered a few days ago at CERN, okay? Mm. Pentaquark is just as impermanent as the cosmos is, right? So those principles of Dhamma are in there. Yeah? So this is why we can include the Four Noble Truths here. Right? So moving on, we now get the detailed explanation of all of the Four Noble Truths, and I will have to chop along a little bit with these, but we'll draw out some of the main points. So, what is the noble truth of suffering? Birth is suffering, old age is suffering, death is suffering, sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness, and depression are suffering. Association with the disliked is suffering, separation from the liked is suffering, not getting what you want is suffering. In brief, the five grasping aggregates are suffering. Okay? So, this is the standard definition of the First Noble Truth, which is found in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, among other places, so the Buddha's first teaching. We're going to look at the definitions of these things in a minute, but are there any questions about that and about how I've chosen to translate anything? I'm just seeing if there's anything controversial there. I'm not getting what you want.
Depression is new, isn't it, or is it not?
Sorry?
Depression?
Depression, yeah, Domina Sahim. Dukkha Domina
Sahim. But it's a very relevant one for many of us, I think. Or me, anyway.
Speaking hypothetically. Yeah, the problem though is that Dhammanasa certainly doesn't mean clinical depression specifically,
no.
But it does mean mental sadness, but yeah.
Mm.
It's not Dhammanasa, of course, it's Upayasa. So it's an intensification of sadness. So I've translated Dhammanasa as sadness. Mm. And upayasa as depression, as being like an intense form of sadness.
Mm. That's exactly
right. Yeah. Often it's translated as despair, but it was pointed out quite a long time ago, despair specifically means giving up hope.
Yeah.
Which is a slightly different thing.
It is, very speaking subjectively, because despair is an existential...
Right.
There is no hope, I can't go on.
Yeah.
Terrible kind of
yeah.
thing that depression isn't.
It's the end of the line.
Yeah. Melancholy,
perhaps. Melancholy, though, is nicer. One of my teachers in Thailand was a poet. She's a monk, and he said melancholy is the most delicious emotion.
Oh, no. I don't agree. For all it's worth, we agree.
Right, yeah.
If the spirits now are not captured in that list, does that mean something's being missed, being left out?
Does that mean something we've seen? Well, you can't have everything. What can I say? But I mean, you know, just despair, something comes out when those things are completely, reach their end, when you give up hope. But, it's just the point is that when those things are defined, there's nothing in the definition that suggests that they're associated with giving up hope.
Could you have sadness and sorrow?
Except you've already got sorrow earlier.
Oh, sorry,
yeah. See, this is the dukkha of a translator,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It's sort of like mental...
A deep mental suffering.
Yeah.
As opposed to dominasa, which is a general mental suffering.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's what he's referring to.
My brother asking us, I think it's in the better emphasized here, in terms of existential suffering.
What do you mean, underemphasized?
Well, it's not about a new country itself. We need to be able to have this, which is a little paragraph on the end. But I mean, that's just an observation.
Yeah. Okay.
Maybe it's just me.
Maybe.
despair would be discounted because you're on the path, and the path doesn't lead to despair.
Well, not necessarily. This is the truth of the Dukkha, right? So
oh,
not, right. It doesn't apply just to people on the path.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it applies to everyone. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions on this one before we move on? Okay, good. Next one. So now I look at the definitions for these ones. So birth, conception, arrival, appearance, manifestation of the aggregates, and gaining of the sense fields of the various sentient beings into the various classes of sentient beings. This is called birth. Okay, so it's a very straightforward definition, contra the interpretations of certain people, birth as jati is always means like birth in the ordinary sense of physical birth, never used in the sense of arising and so on, at least not in this kind of context. Old age, aging, broken teeth, graying hair and wrinkled skin of the various sentient beings and the various classes of sentient beings, this is called old age. And once again, simply and straightforwardly referring to physical aging. What is death? The passing away, falling away, breakup, disappearance, mortality, death, completing the time, breaking up of the aggregates, laying down of the corpse, cutting off the life faculty, pining for the fjords of the various sentient beings from the various classes of sentient beings. This is called death. Okay. So it seems like not just in modern times, we have lots of synonyms for dying as well. Yeah.
Just with the sentient beings, does that include the non-physical beings?
Sure, why not?
I'm just wondering why sentient in that.
Because that's what people normally say. Yeah, the Pali word is sattva, but if you kind of listen how people use words in the Buddhist culture, people usually don't say beings, they usually say sentient beings. That's why I put it there. I think it's, you know, I think there's a reason for it. I think it's just clearer of what it means. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Aging, death. So this stuff's all sufferings, right? And sorrow. Now, most of the next set of definitions are not that interesting. And here we have what is a very, very Abhidhammic style of definition. And what essentially you're doing is just you're presenting a bunch of lexical alternatives to the word, which you can try to capture in English, but it's not very meaningful. And sorrow, sorrowing, sorrowfulness, inner sorrow, and so on and so forth. That's basically just a bunch of sort of variants of the form of the word. So there's nothing hugely interesting there. So let's just skip through sorrow and lamentation. To suffering, what's dukkha? The bodily pain, bodily unpleasantness, painful and unpleasant feeling arising from bodily contact. This is called pain. Oh, there's an inconsistency there, isn't it? But what is suffering? Okay, so yeah, it needs to be what is pain at the beginning. So fix that. So what's her wish?
The previous
page
of the
annotation,
should we have
buffering and location of the annotation? Oh, sorry, yeah, no, you're right, yeah, there's a mistake there. Okay, yeah, good, thank you. I did this translation very quickly, so there's a few mistakes in it. I've been fixing it up as I go along.
I just had a note somewhere, did that generic may happen?
Oh, very, very much so. Yeah, you can easily get these things happen, and there's a number of cases where things have happened. When you have any particular medium will tend to introduce its own kind of errors, right? So there's no error, no medium which is error-free. So in like recitation, you know, there are glitches which are introduced because of the nature of memory, right? And one of the things that memory does is that it's something you really notice when you're reciting something. So for example, in the monastic community, we recite out the Padimokkha, the list of rules, right? And you get certain rules, for example, which might start with the same phrase and then have a different phrase, right? And so that's very common that you know, if your attention wavers or something, you trip up and you put that second phrase in where the first phrase should have been there because you've got that association there. And so that kind of thing, that's a kind of a memory style glitch. Right? Now, if you then put it in a written medium, okay, you then tend to get different kinds of errors appearing. So, for example, you might get an error appearing because certain letters might look similar in that particular script, right? And you see that even on computers today, right? If you're editing a document using Arial, right, You're going to get your capital I's and your L's mixed up, because Arial is a terrible font, which should be uninstalled from all of the computers in the world, okay? Right? And if you're writing a font which is supposed to distinguish letters and you can't distinguish between one capital I and L, then you've failed as a font designer, right? So those kinds of glitches, but also you can get glitches in written manuscripts where you do things like you might accidentally like skip a paragraph, a bit like you do when you're reading something, like imagine you're copying from one manuscript to another, like sometimes when you're reading a book, like your eye might skip a paragraph without you quite noticing it, so you can do things like that. So there's certain errors which you find in the manuscript tradition. And now that we have the text in a digital form, then of course we can introduce like copy and paste errors and things like that, which are characteristic of a digital medium.
So if you don't believe, you kind of know how to identify the types of mistakes and what sorts of mistakes to look for. And
exactly, but also the reverse. When you see the kind of mistakes, you can deduce what's form, what medium that was created in, right? And that's one of the things. It was actually done by my friend Rob Bucknell, who's part of the sort of central team, and he was one of the first scholars that started looking into that. So you can distinguish like certain errors that maybe, say, in a Chinese translation, and you can distinguish, was this something that was introduced in China, or was it introduced in India? It was part of that text that was translated. Was it something that was introduced as part of the oral tradition, or something that was more likely to be introduced as part of the manuscript tradition? So that's one of the ways you can do it. You can see that there are certain kinds of mistakes which do seem to be oral mistakes, mistakes in the oral tradition. So and other mistakes, obviously, which are just made because somebody's dumb and they do dumb things like me. And then that one's also, the next one's mistaken as well. Oh, it's a good thing we looked at this. Okay, so what's sadness, mental pain, mental unpleasantness? To come back to what is pain, right? So the word here is dukkha. And of course, dukkha in the broad sense means suffering and means, you know, everything that is less peaceful than nirvana, okay, comes under dukkha. Right? But also dukkha is used in a more specific sense to mean physical pain, and that's what the definition here is. So when we have dukkha here, best to translate it as pain, bodily pain, bodily unpleasantness, painful and unpleasant feeling arising from bodily contact. This is called pain. And what is sadness? This is dominasa. Mental pain, mental unpleasantness, painful, unpleasant feeling arising from mind contact. This is called sadness or dominasa. And what's depression? Upayasa. The depression of anyone who's afflicted by some kind of misfortune or has some kind of painful experience. This is called depression. Perhaps you should translate it as post-traumatic stress.
In my case, yeah.
That's what it looks like, doesn't it? It's actually specifically the sadness that comes after experiencing having a bad experience. Yeah. I'll have a think about that, but anyway.
Trauma.
Sorry?
Trauma.
Maybe trauma, yeah.
Some kind of trauma would allow for a large and small trauma.
Looks like that's what it's getting at, doesn't it? Yeah. Does depression have the same?
So what was the original word in that context?
Upayasa.
I don't know.
It's not a very common word, yeah.
I'd say trauma probably would be the equivalent.
Looks like it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Maybe I'll put that in.
Yeah, misfortune sounds like you went to the shop and they were out of coffee or something like that.
Yeah, that's not. It's more talking like if your children die or something like that. That's actually what it's about.
Yeah, the father dies in the wrong way.
Okay, good. So the next one, what is association with the disliked is suffering. So notice that there's kind of two aspects which are taught here. Coming together, gathering togetherness, being mixed up with the unwished for, unwanted, unpleasing sight, sound, smell, taste, touch as a mental phenomena, or with those who desire your loss, harm, discomfort, and continued entrapment. Mm. This is called association with the disliked. So here it means both association with people that you dislike, right? But also more specifically in the psychological context with any kind of experience which you find unpleasant. Actually, I think probably the original meaning of it was association with people that you disliked. Okay, the word here, pia, is very commonly used in Pali. It's apiye hisampayogo dukho. The word pia is very commonly used to mean like people who are dear to you, like your family and friends and things like that. And apiye is the opposite. So I think what's happened here is you've got a definition which originally meant, you know, being surrounded by enemies or people you dislike and so on. But it was kind of extended to have more of that psychological nuance of saying, well, any experience which you dislike. So you sort of translate it so it can apply to both of those things. Okay, and the next one. Separation from the light, coming together, the not coming together, not gathering, untogetherness, not being mixed up with wished for, wanted, pleasing sight, sound, smell, taste, touch as a mental phenomena, or with those who desire your benefit, welfare, comfort, and release from entrapment, whether mother, father, brother, sister, friend, companion, relatives, and family members. This is called separation from the liked, is suffering. And what monastics is not getting what you want is suffering. Sentient beings, those subject to birth, wish, oh, may we not be subject to birth, may birth not come to us, but we cannot get this by wishing. Those subject to old age, they wish, may we not be subject to old age, may old age not come to us. Those subject to affliction, or those subject to death, they wish, may we not be subject to death, may death not come to us, but you cannot get this by wishing. This is subject to sorrow, pain, lamentation, pain, sadness, and depression. They wish, may we not be subject to these things. May they not come to us, but you cannot get this by wishing. This is not getting what you want, is suffering. So notice there's a slight sort of curious inconsistency in the text here, that it actually has a birth, old age, affliction, and death, okay, diapada, which isn't in the earlier text. We just had birth, old age, and death. And this is somewhat of a systemic inconsistency found in these texts and in the descriptions of the Four Noble Truths and the analysis of it. Sometimes affliction or illness is found in there, and sometimes it's not. Okay, I won't sort of go into any more detail in that. I haven't actually investigated it. Why that's the case, or what the earlier version is, or anything, but just to notice that there are sometimes those variations. And what monastics is, in brief, the five grasping aggregates of suffering. These are the grasping aggregates of form, feeling, perception, choices, and consciousness. Okay, so we've already discussed those. So that's the definition of the origin. Oh, sorry, of suffering. Mm. Any questions on that before we move on? Okay. Next one. Noble truth of the origin of suffering. What monastics is the noble truth of the origin of suffering? The craving that leads to rebirth in future lives, bound up with delight and lust. It delights in this or that state of existence. That is, sensual craving, craving to be reborn and craving to be annihilated. And once more, this is the standard definition lifted straight from the Buddha's first sermon, the Dhammapada Sutta, and defining what is that is the cause of suffering. And this is, of course, in many different places, many different suttas, this is defined in different ways. And sometimes we have ignorance as the cause, or free fires or different kinds of things, but in the context of the Four Noble Truths, it's always the craving, tanha, which is the origin of suffering. So here I've translated it in a way that might perhaps be somewhat controversial. It's the phrase is yayam tanha pono bhavika, and I've translated it as the craving that leads to rebirth in future lives. That's clearly what the Pali means. Although it's become somewhat popular in the secular Buddhist circles to argue or to present the Four Noble Truths as if they don't talk about rebirth, but that's just wrong. The Four Noble Truths talk about rebirth all the time. Pono Bhava. Pona means another or further, and Bhava means a state of rebirth. Okay? So Pono Bhavika means something that leads to rebirth in a future life. Any questions?
Annihilated. In what circumstances would a person wish to be annihilated? Would that mean suicidal?
Basically, a strong form of it. A lesser form would be just have one too many drinks and knock yourself out, right? But it's just the desire to not be conscious. The desire to not be. All of those kinds of negative things. And that's one of the things, of course, Freud noticed, that, the obvious thing is that we want to be, or we want to have pleasure and so on. These are obvious drives. But then sometimes people's behavior can't really be described, can't really be understood in that way. And we see that self-destructive behavior and all of these things. And so somehow underneath, there's this, that we have this desire to, I think it comes from like a misconstrued perception of suffering, We see that it's suffering, we don't see a way out, right? We just want to make an end of it.
It's almost like despair, isn't it?
It is, yeah. So I think it's there in all of us in subtle forms, but then it can sort of come out much more strongly in some cases. Suicidal tendencies, I think, like drug addiction, these kinds of things.
In the case of that lower realms, you said being sexual life in the punishment that's sort of doled out.
There's an interesting sutta where the Anuruddha talks about, like a flies that are born, they delight in their rebirth as a fly. I mean, look, I don't think it literally means if you're reborn in like a pot of boiling lead struck by spears all the time that you can necessarily delight in that. But it's just a sense that you're attached to rebirth in some form or another.
It's sort of bound up with delight and life. Just thinking in terms of the lower realm, how that would
Alright, moving on. Okay, so then it goes on to a long kind of explanation of that, which is perhaps, I think, a little bit kind of excessive, but certainly very characteristic of the sort of Abhidhamma way of exposition. Where does that craving arise and where does it settle? That craving arises and settles on whatever in the world seems nice and pleasant. Okay? Loke pirupang sata rupang is the phrase here. Pia, we mentioned before, meaning like dear or nice or something like that. And pleasant, sata, is already found in the definition of pleasure, right? Of the Vedanakanda is sata. But they have a suffix here. Pia rupa sata rupa. Okay? And the word rupa in this context doesn't mean form, as in physical form, but has an idiomatic meaning. Remember I said before that sometimes rupa has this kind of nuance of appearance, right? So sometimes rupa means like something, they appear nice, they appear pleasant, or they seem nice and they seem pleasant, right? So this is what rupa means in this context, pia rupa, sata rupa. It doesn't mean having a pleasant shape, it means that they seem as if they're nice and pleasant. So what in the world seems nice and pleasant? The eye, the ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. And here it is that craving arises and settles, and then goes through the internal senses, external senses, consciousness, contact, feeling, perception, intentions, craving, thinking, vitaka, and exploring, vichara, and in all of these cases. So again, I won't go through all of these things in too much detail, but basically you can see that tendency to develop a very kind of systematic sort of analysis of all the different kinds of experience, which is something that we very closely associate with the Abhidhamma movement. then to the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. It is the fading away and cessation, giving up, relinquishment. Giving up is chaga, relinquishment, patinisaga, letting go, mukti, and non-attachment, analyo, to that very same craving without anything left over. And where is that craving abandoned? And where does it cease? The craving is abandoned. It ceases on whatever in the world seems nice and pleasant. And whatever in the world seems nice and pleasant. The eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, sight, sound, smell, touch, and so on and so forth. Throughout all of the same lists of dhammas. So the important point here is that it is the same field, right? The same things that give rise to craving and attachment. It's the same thing where you let go of those cravings and attachments. Right? That's really the important point here. It is an unusual way of presenting the Four Noble Truths. More characteristically, in the suttas, if you were to expand the Four Noble Truths in more detail, it would do so in terms of dependent origination. So that's something that you might expect to appear in this particular context. But like I said, the presentation here is quite lay and is clearly derived from the Abhidhamma, which explains its rather unusual form.
Okay.
If you wanted to plug it in, you'd plug it into the second and third noble truths, yeah.
What was that, sorry? It wasn't plugged into the first and second?
Second and third noble truths, dependent origination.
Oh.
Yeah. So third of truth would be the reverse order, yes, exactly. Yeah. Okay, so I'm rushing through these bits a little bit because we're getting to the noble truth of the path, where we have the much more interesting definitions. And so the noble truth of the path, what is the noble truth of the practice leading to the cessation of suffering? It is precisely this noble eightfold path. That is, right view, right motivation, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right samadhi. So, what is right view? It is knowledge about suffering, the origin of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the practice leading to the cessation of suffering. This is called right view. So, this is that kind of fractal idea that I was mentioning before, that we can include the Noble Eightfold Path within the Four Noble Truths, but we also include the Four Noble Truths within the Eightfold Path. They kind of reflect each other. Different aspects of the same thing. Right view here is defined fairly specifically in terms of the knowledge regarding suffering, and right view of course, stands at the head of the Noble Eightfold Path. Now, the word view, the word dipti in Pali, is actually quite well translated as view. Sometimes it's translated as right understanding, but this is incorrect. A view, a dipti, is a theory. Okay, and in Thai, when they use the word theory, they use the Sanskritized form of the word Pali word dipti. So you have the what? How do they say it? The Tritsadi Heng Kwang Sampan. Tritsadi Heng Kwang Sampan, I think it is the theory of relativity. And the Tritsadi Heng Gan Diwat is the theory of evolution. Right? So they use that same word, dipti, or view, to talk about a theory, right? And that's exactly what it is, right? So what stands at the beginning of the path is the right theory about the path. It means having the right idea. Okay, so that's what we're doing here in the classes, reading suttas, discussing things, clarifying our ideas, and so on and so forth. So this is developing your right view. And this is the beginning of the development of the wisdom factor from Buddhism. Now, that wisdom, because it uses the word jnana here, translated as knowledge, jnana is a very general term which can apply to wisdom you develop it of any kind, right? So it includes that theoretical wisdom, but it also includes the wisdom that you gain from your experience, through your life experience and so on, but also the wisdom you gain through your experience with meditation and ultimately the experience of enlightenment itself, which is the culmination of the path. So this right view, this samadhi, begins with that theoretical knowledge, and that theoretical knowledge is deepened and refined, and it emerges at the end of the path as that deeper wisdom and insight into the truth. So the same things which you saw originally, you merely had a theoretical grasp of, and later on you know by experience. Okay? Any questions on that one?
Dependent origination controversial.
So very controversial, yeah. Dependent origination, jhanas and bhikkhunis.
That's why they've got the more neutral existential sort of self breaking. I mean, when asked an original question, I see why it's not expanded in the first one, because it's expanded
elsewhere.
In the second one, well, that existential self through the aggregate, so
right.
The aggregate is expanded. But then origination is much richer in terms of more causal.
It is. It is. It's much more richer and much more nuanced. And what you have here is much more kind of formulaic.
But you think it's controversial?
Oh, it's got nothing to do with whether it's controversial. I don't know why it's included here, because it's congruent with the Abhidhamma style of analysis. Mm. That's why it's included there.
It seems to be important.
Dependent origination wasn't necessarily controversial at that time. It is these days. What's the controversy?
It's about rebirth.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. Right. So there's a kind of movement which interprets dependent origination as applying only to a single life, whereas the suttas and the traditions all see it as being the explanation of how rebirth happens, especially how rebirth happens without a self.
Mm.
Yeah. Once you take that out, then you don't have that explanation. So what they do is they take out the dependent origination, they say it applies only in this life, and then they turn around and say, and see, how can rebirth happen without a self? There's no teaching in Buddhism on that. Right? So, I think this is all kind of a misunderstanding. I think it's very unfortunate that the teaching on dependent origination is, it's like leached of its richness when it's seen solely in that context. I mean, there are plenty of places where the Buddha talked about how our psychology, our mind evolves in the present, right? I mean, there's stacks of suttas that talk about how our thoughts and so on influence our states of mind and emotions and things like that. You know, so it's not as if there's any lack of teachings on those things. But what the structure of the Dhamma needs is something that talks about how this rebirth happens as a process of conditions, rather than something which requires a metaphysical postulate, like the idea of the self.
Is there any questions for including part of it and missing out the controversial bit about people? Just as a more causal explanation. I've spent all this time understanding feelings and the mind and things. You know, the traditions and the center origination.
Well, it's not what you have there is not completely different from dependent origination. But look, you know, it's just the text as we have it. Different bits of the Dhamma are included in different places, that's all. Yeah, that's not such a big deal.
Is there any precedent for people saying feelings, crazy?
There's precedent for almost anything that you could ask in the world, right? I mean, what can I say? I mean, craving causing suffering is part of dependent origination. Right? I mean, these things are always there. Yeah, of course, it's everywhere in the Dhamma. But we have only half an hour left in the retreat, so I'm not going to start talking about dependent origination. That would have to be the next retreat. Okay, moving along. Right motivation, the motivation of renunciation, of non-ill will and non-harming. This is called right motivation. So the part of it here, sankappa. Sometimes sankappa means intention, sometimes it means thought. Okay, and it's often translated in one of those two ways, but here the function of Sankapa in the Noble Eightfold Path, it seems to me, is to like set the direction. It's like giving a kind of an emotional response, right? You have the Four Noble Truths, you understand the idea of the Four Noble Truths, and then that sets a direction for your life, right? And it tells you, the Four Noble Truths are telling you that you're not going to be happy by holding on to things, so you practice letting go. It tells you that, that beings are suffering, and so we should have compassion for them and loving kindness, right? So it's giving us like a motivation, which is moving our life in a certain direction. Okay, so this is why I've chosen to use right motivation here, to sort of bring out that sense of that kind of overall emotional orientation of the path, which I think is what Sama Sankapa is getting at.
Like resolve?
Something like resolve is sometimes used, yeah. Yeah. But it's certainly not incorrect to translate it as right thought or right intention.
Mm-hmm. It's like something you don't make a decision about once. It's an ongoing,
very much so,
discriminatory, yeah, awareness.
Well, that's right. You know, and we have, you know, even if we understand Four Noble Truths,
mm-hmm,
not all of your intentions are in line with that, right?
Yeah.
So it's part of a, you know, constant thing. But, you know, this is in terms of you know, the bits and pieces of Buddhism that get sort of sucked up into psychology. This is basically CBT.
Right.
This is essentially what you're talking about. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's all right, we don't mind. they can have all these different bits itself.
Yeah.
Okay. So right motivation, and so if right motivation naturally moves on to the section on ethics and behaviour, okay? So obviously your motivation, what is the emotional state of your mind and your intention and so on, is very closely associated with what kind of speech you make. So refraining from lying, divisive speech, harsh speech and meaningless speech, this is called right speech. So notice that the definition of right speech in the Eightfold Path is broader than it is in the five precepts, which just have refraining from lying, okay, and many other places. In fact, by far the most common and normal presentation of right speech is it presents speech in a positive way, right? So you use speech which is meaningful, which is kind, which is clear, which is going to the heart, which is reconciling those who are divided. Use speech which is at the right time, very good, important quality of speech. And which is meaningful, connected with what is of meaning. So right speech doesn't, here it's just phrased in a negative sense, but it obviously it doesn't mean that, and it's more, in fact normally presented in a positive way. Okay, so don't think that you can just practice right speech just by not speaking. We talked about this a bit at the beginning of the retreat in the context of the practice of silence. Right action, refraining from killing living beings, from stealing and from sexual misconduct. And of course this is also a phrase in a negative sense, but normally phrased also in a positive sense in the suttas. It talks about, for example, the first precept is like living with your heart full of compassion for all sentient beings. Okay, so it doesn't just mean not killing them, but acting in a way that expresses that compassion and that loving kindness for all beings. Killing and stealing are relatively straightforward. Sexual misconduct is a little bit more complex because it's so strongly determined by cultural expectations and cultural conditions and so on. But it's important to understand that sexual misconduct in Buddhism doesn't mean some kind of sex that I don't like. Okay. It means kind of an activity or doing something in your sexual relations that betrays the trust and the love which somebody else has given you and which causes harm to them because of your betrayal of them. That's essentially what it means. So of course there are things which are obviously in outright cases of sexual misconduct, such as rape, pedophilia, and so on and so forth. And there are other things which depend on the context, right? And so, for example, there's no requirement in Buddhism that, say, you have an exclusive partner, all right? And in fact, it was very normal in ancient India that there would be that a man might have multiple wives or something like that. Certainly important, because the crucial thing is that everybody knows what's going on, right? As long as everyone's happy with the arrangement, basically, then that's fine. So it's not necessarily a good idea, but it's not necessarily breaking the precept as well, right? So there's a difference between saying, well, look, I think it's a skillful way to live your life, right? But it's not necessarily, there's no prescription that you have to do that. If you find that's how you want to live, that's fine. And so we've had the same thing with the same-sex marriage and so on. So this is why I'm very proud of the Australian Buddhist community for supporting the same-sex marriage, which we've done consistently for a number of years. And this is based on, first of all, based on compassion and understanding that people with different kinds of sexuality, whether gay people, trans people, and so on and so forth, they've suffered a lot. And they've suffered all kinds of discrimination and things, and it's a very terrible thing, and it accomplishes nothing. It achieves nothing. All it does is make people suffer. And it's embarrassing that religions have become so obsessed with controlling what other people do in their bedrooms. It's just ridiculous, you know. It's like somehow that's a requirement of what being religious means. Is that it's like everyone else is having more fun than you are, and so you've got to stop them from having fun, you know. And it's just so mean spirited and stupid. And I think it's a great shame that in the Eastern religions, that even though these things have never been a prominent part of Eastern religions, but they are being imported from Western attitudes. And the Abrahamic religions have been homophobic for centuries. And these attitudes are being imported into Buddhism. And you see them sometimes expressed in Buddhism and Buddhist communities. And we need to understand these things are completely alien from the Buddhist culture. They only appeared in the Buddhist culture in texts. There are first mentions of these things is only in passing, and occasional mentions occur around the 4th century AD, which is after the Buddhism had a long exposure to Western thought and Western ideas. Okay, it's after the Greeks have been living in India for hundreds of years, and it's after there's been exposure to all kinds of different ideas and so on. Massive trade had been going on with the West, with Christian countries and things like that for hundreds of years. And so you find occasional references to these things, which is clearly different from what we find in the early texts. But even though there are occasional references in these early texts of around the 4th or 5th century, that's like 1,000 years after the Buddha nearly, we still don't, it's not by no means a major theme or anything which is particularly important within the Buddhist tradition. And as was there's a statement by the Attorney General of India on this a couple of years ago, and he's talking about the terrible homophobia which has often become a part of the extremist Hindutva movement in India. And he made the point that when the English colonized India, that India was like the favorite holiday destination for all the gay Englishmen, right? Who would all go over to India because everything was much more relaxed there, and nobody was so discriminating. And that was the actual Indian tradition. And when that sort of became, you know, well known that was what was happening, then the English decided to make a law banning homosexuality in India. And then later on, the Hindus forget that that's what happened, and they say this is our Hindu tradition, and we have to guard our Hindu tradition. It's happened all over Asia, all over the Buddhist tradition, so many times. People have internalized attitudes from the West and then claim them as our ancient Buddhist traditions. You know, when I was in Perth some time ago. Some of the Malaysian women from the Buddhist society was talking, and she's saying, you know, we should stop the you see that like women come to the monastery wearing like a singlet or something like that, and we should, you know, that's not the Buddhist tradition. Our Buddhist tradition, you have to cover yourself up and so on and so forth. And I said, well, look, if you look at the actual Buddhist paintings in Sri Lanka and Thailand, women were usually topless when they came to the monastery. Yeah. So do you think that's a tradition that we should be imposing on people? Well, we might have a little bit of wiggle room there. So So, you know, we internalize these kind of attitudes, and that's a reality. Anyone, if you're familiar with the old paintings and so on in Sri Lanka and things, that's obviously how it was. And so these attitudes are very often, you know, they're something which has come from modernity and come often from a Western influence. And so that doesn't necessarily mean it's wrong or we should disregard them, but we use our discernment, right? We don't just mindlessly say that we're going to adopt this thing. And in some cases, it might be good things. In other cases, it might not. And so we have to look at whether it's causing suffering or not. That's the main thing. So in the case of sexual conduct, then, you know, it is a very controversial area. It's an area where there's a lot of disagreement of opinions around the world. It's an area where people's attitudes and so on are changing a lot. And I've been in situations a number of times where I'm sort of consulted on this, and you're sort of with a group, and there's like the Jews and the Christians and the Muslims, and they ask all about these attitudes towards all these things. And by the time it gets to me, I'm thinking to myself, I am so glad I'm a Buddhist. And I can just answer these things so straightforwardly and simply, and I don't have to sort of bend over myself, right? You know, homosexuality is an aberration, not a perversion, right? And these kinds of, you know, ways you have of wriggling out of these things, our sexual behavior and sexual conduct is an area that can create great suffering, okay? My baby done left me, I'm lonesome, I want to die, right? I mean, this all happens all the time. So it is an area where we need to be careful and we need to consider the ethical implications of our choices, right? So that needs to happen. But we need to keep thinking of that with compassion of what's actually creating suffering and not some kind of rigid idea about what we have right as wrong. Yeah, yeah.
It seems like the beginning
to have an ego and
self-identity
I agree. I think that, you know, it's based on those kinds of things. Yeah, and it's astonishing. I mean, even if you look, say, in the theistic traditions, I mean, you find in the Old Testament you find one or two statements about homosexuality, right? It's not like it's a kind of major theme there, you know, and yet somehow it's become this big sort of cause. I mean, you know, I mean, this is as well known, you know, there's plenty of statements in the Old Testament that say, you know, you shouldn't eat shellfish and you shouldn't collect firewood on a Sunday. If somebody collects firewood on a Sunday, they should be stoned to death, right? And if it's your family member, you know, your brother or sister, then you should make sure that you are the first person to throw the stone. You know, so there are plenty of things in there which we're not necessarily going to be adopting in the fullest sense of the word, and we might be seeking for more of a metaphorical interpretation of them. But then somehow, you know, there's certain things which you pick up which actually, you know, and it depends on how you handle your tradition. This is something which, you know, I've mentioned before, but it was very sort of nicely came out in the Senate inquiry when they asked us to present from our religious basis on same-sex marriage. And they specifically asked us what's the textual basis for our positions. And so this was the federal Senate inquiry that was held a couple of years ago. And I attended the hearing they had in Perth, in Sydney. And when the Christians presented, we had the Anglicans and the Catholics, who, of course, in Sydney, the leadership of the Anglicans and Catholics are extremely conservative, right? I mean, the people aren't necessarily like that, but the leadership is. And so they're basically like, you know, there's only one and only one form of marriage, and that's what happened in the Garden of Eden. And there was Adam and Eve, and it wasn't Adam and Steve, right? And so that's basically is their argument, which, okay, whatever. But then the Jewish fellow said, well, actually, Adam and Eve weren't married. Right? So, what lesson are you going to draw from that? Yeah? Oh, actually, why don't we abolish marriage? You know, why bother? Yeah. And so this is the thing, is, you know, you have these scriptures, right, which have a bunch of words in them, but how do you, what meaning do you take out of them? How do you read them, you know? And, you know, this is a point that Bhikkhu Bodhi made many years ago when we did the Bhikkhuni Congress at Hamburg. And they said that, you know, you can read the Vinaya and so on, and you can interpret it in different ways, but we should try to read it in a compassionate way. Right? The purpose of the text is to try to help people to overcome suffering. It's not to try to prevent people from practicing Dhamma. And if you're reading the text in a way that's stopping people from practicing Dhamma, you're reading them wrong. Yeah? So we always, when we're approaching the suttas and things like that, remember that it's a creative act. Reading is a creative act. It's not a passive act. Right? The meaning is not locked up in those words that we read. Okay? The meaning is something that arises when you read it and you reflect on it, and it creates a meaning. It is a relationship between you and the text. Okay? And so the text itself will guide that meaning, right? But it doesn't determine it. Right? And that's why there are so many people can read the same text and then interpret it in so many different ways. Okay? So always bear this in mind when we're reading things, that there's always that openness about it. We're participating in creating meaning through the text. Okay. So, any questions on? So, you know, so this is this whole kind of thing, and we go there and we're asked these questions about sexual misconduct and stuff like that. And I'm like, I'm a monk. Why are they asking me these questions? I don't know. Anyway, so it's happened to me so many times now. I just get used to it. Whatever. And I remember years ago, Ajahn Brahm did a radio interview with a sex therapist. Right? And so it was like a talkback radio with some kind of relationship sex counselor, therapist, and they asked Ajahn Brahm to come and do this interview. And Ajahn Brahm would do anything, right? He did an interview on shipping years ago, right? So I got like this interesting magazine on international shipping, and they asked Ajahn Brahm to do an interview on global shipping. So he's like, yeah, sure. So he did this thing, and apparently it became very, very kind of viral in the shipping industry. So they were getting Ajahn Brahm's opinions on shipping. Anyway, so he did this one on sex therapy, right? And relationships and couples therapy. And you've got this sex therapist who's, that's their job, and they do this radio show every week. And Ajahn Brahm did an interview, and then they get people to call in, and all of the callers asked to speak to Ajahn Brahm. Yeah, quite interesting. So, okay. So, any questions on that before we move on? Good. Move on. Sexual misconduct. Okay, next one, right, livelihood. Here, noble disciple abandons wrong livelihood and makes a living by right livelihood, which is a somewhat disappointing definition, I have to say. Elsewhere, of course, we have the five kinds of right livelihood, or five kinds of wrong livelihood, rather, which is trade in, what are they, trade in meat, trade in living beings, trade in animals, trade in poisons, trade in weapons, yeah? So these are the kinds of wrong livelihood. Of course, these days, human beings being the creative little things that we are, we've got many other kinds of wrong livelihood that you can do. And a seemingly diminishing pile of right livelihoods too. So I guess you know, there's just so many different kinds of right livelihood that it's difficult to summarize them. And it's also quite different for monastics as for lay people. But generally speaking, for lay people, for right livelihood, any kind of livelihood which is A, beneficial, and B, doesn't break any precepts, would normally be considered to be right livelihood, okay? So, you know, most of the time if you're doing like a trade or a craft, you know, if you're cooking or building things, farming the soil, all of these kinds of things are considered to be right livelihood, whereas things that you're doing that are actively harmful are considered to be wrong livelihood. Of course, there are many dubious cases in between things that you might wonder, is this right livelihood or is this not? For example, what about being a soldier? Is that right livelihood? Killing is wrong, but not all soldiers kill. So this is somewhat, you know, you'd have to think about it, right? I mean, and I think that, you know, it's probably you want to avoid maybe making a black and white statement on that. What about being working in the advertising industry, right? I mean, your job is to increase desire and delusion. Yeah? And, you know, again, I think it depends on how you use it. I was in KL a year or two ago, and we got picked up by someone, and they were talking, and the lady who was driving said her husband worked in the advertising industry. And my sort of heart fell a little bit. I thought, oh, okay, that's nice. And then she said, and now he's, you know, he became disillusioned with that, and so now he works developing public information campaigns on health for the government. Right? I thought, oh, okay, that's nice. Right? So there's a way that you can actually, those same skills that you use in advertising actually can be used in a positive way. It's not everything that comes out of the advertising industry is unwholesome. Most things probably are. But anyway, so certainly you can try. And I don't think now's the time to get into a long discussion of livelihood, but I think that perhaps the biggest problem we have with livelihood today, in addition to the problems of right livelihood and wrong livelihood, is the bigger problem of meaningless livelihood, right? Doing jobs where you just don't know what the point is anymore, right? And that is very, very soul destroying. Yeah? And that's something which, you know, has definitely happened much more in our day as compared to the Buddhist day. You see your work, you see the results of your work. I think, you know, if you're still working in like a trade or something like that, it can still be quite meaningful. Like you build something, there it is. You know, you can actually feel that sense of satisfaction that you've actually built, you know, a home or something. People can go and stay there, or you fix something. But then if you're sitting behind a computer all day and just, you know, writing a bit of code or, you know, doing something like that, writing a policy or something, and it gets sent off, and what difference does it make? Yeah, end of the day. So, you know, I think this is a big problem, but anyway, that's not too, that's not too much detail here, but any questions on right livelihood before we move on? Solution, you just have to do your best. But I do think it's, I think the most important thing is that you take some responsibility for it. You know, you're part of that organization. You're part of, you know, you can say, oh, the culture in this organization is toxic, but you're part of that culture, right? I mean, that doesn't mean you're the cause of the problems, but you are participating in what's happening. So you have to take responsibility for your own actions. And, you know, see, is there anything you can do? Is there a way, either maybe through just your personal integrity, or through, you know, actions and so on, you can do, can you make a positive difference? If you find that you're in a place where you really can't, where you're trying to make a positive difference and it just doesn't work, you're constantly being undermined and shut down and so on, then that's probably when you need to start thinking of being somewhere else.
I think most environments, people don't see the need. You know,
don't see the...
The context is so complex and you can't build a situational awareness of
right.
That they don't see the need.
Right.
Most people reduce it maybe for expenses to bring in money.
Right, as long as you...
The only meaning is to look after your bonding.
Yeah.
Whereas they might be doing for work.
And then that's the...
That's the end of the organisation.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's the long-term thing, isn't it? I mean, it probably doesn't matter for a while, right? You do it for a few years and you show up to work and you get you know, you're just happy to have a paycheck, you know? Maybe only after a number of years, maybe you hit your 40s or something like that and you look back and you think, what have I actually accomplished? Sorry? Well, that's right, yeah. I did a dana at a house a number of years ago, a couple of years ago now, a young Sri Lankan couple, and they just moved into a new home and bought their new home and stuff. And they told me the story that when they finalized their mortgage for the new home, that day they went to work and they came back, and the husband said to the wife, when I went to work, I told the boss that we've got our mortgage on our home. And the boss just laughed and said, oh, we've got you now. And the wife just looked at him and said, my boss said exactly the same thing.
My boss said the same thing. You're a really good employee.
What do you have in mind when we're doing small actions? I mean, do we always have to be with the broad policy? I mean, is
sure.
Sort of doing the right action within the small function that we perform?
Can be, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, and yeah, very, very often it is, yeah. But I mean, there are also cases when, you know, you just feel that's useless, you know, everything you do is just being undermined. But yeah, sure. In life, most of the time, it's just little things. And if you can, you know, make your workplace a bit brighter, a bit happier, be a bit kinder to people you work with, treat them with respect and so on, then that's really important.
Yeah.
Okay. So, right, livelihood. Right effort. And we've already looked at right effort in the context of meditation, so I won't go into this again. Right mindfulness. Satipatthana, and so again the kind of the fractal nature, it's all sort of included in there, and so that's again is, I won't go into it in detail, and then finally right samadhi, where we have the four jhanas, which we have not met up to now, and so here I'll just go through the jhana formula fairly quickly. Unfortunately we don't have time to do it in a lot of detail, even though it's very important teaching obviously. But here you can see that in the Eightfold Path, as always, that right samadhi comes after right mindfulness. So it's like the combination of it. We saw through Satipatthana that through the development of mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feelings, and mindfulness of the mind, that the way that's expressed within the text, while not explicitly talking about the jhanas, is clearly meaning to imply states of jhanas. And here is the most common passage, which is defining what those states are. And just a sort of remark as a historical note, meditation obviously wasn't invented before the Buddha. It's very difficult to know from a text exactly what kind of meditation state that somebody's experiencing. So in the pre-Buddhist texts, you find many mentions of things which seem like meditative or contemplative expressions, right? Phrases that talk about things in a way that sound like that's what a meditator would say. But what we don't find is like a clearly described and defined states of meditation like we find in the suttas. So this is one of the most significant innovations which the Buddha introduced, was to be able to talk about states of meditation in purely psychological terms. Okay, so to analyze the state of meditation, normally people will interpret those meditation states in some sort of metaphysical sense, right? So it's absorption with the oneness of the universe, or it's an experience of coming face to face with God or something like that. And so that's the only kind of, the experience is so overwhelming and so powerful that that's the only kind of language that seems adequate to talk about it. And so when the Buddha was talking about it, he was able to have enough equanimity, enough insight to look and say that even though these experiences are so strong and so powerful, that still actually what is going on there is just these mental qualities. These mental qualities that are happening in the jhanas are similar to mental qualities that we're experiencing in ordinary consciousness, okay? Except, obviously, they're not, right? I mean, obviously, it's a transformed state of mind. It's the adi, citta, the higher mind. It's still citta, but it's also adi, okay? It's the higher mind. So it's the same things we ordinarily experience, but they're transformed and elevated, okay? So the word jhana is the root meaning of the word jhana comes back to, and I think probably is originally derived from, a very, very famous passage in the Rig Veda called the Gayatri Mantra. And the Gayatri Mantra is probably the most common passage or verse which was recited by Hindu priests in India up till today, and recited at the rising of the sun. Om Bhu Bhu Varsva Tat Savitur Varenyam Bhagodevasya Dimahi Diyoyo Naha Prachodayam, which translates, not an easy verse to translate, but it means something like homage to the three realms, that glorious rising sun whose divine radiance impels my mind towards awakening. Something like that. Om Bhu Bhu Varsva Tat Savitur Varenyam, that glorious rising sun. Diyoyo na prachode bhargode vasya dimahi. And so it has this divine radiance, devo. And the word dhi in there, dhi, it means something like, think of what it's like when you don't have electricity. Think of what it's like when you can't just switch on the light when you want to. Think of what it's like to live in a world where at night time, you've got maybe a lamp or something like that, but that's all. And night time is actually really dark all the time. We're so disconnected from this. What is it like to live in a place where the night time is really dark? And then when you awake, and you awake with that rising sun, and the incredible power, the light, the life, the warmth, that everything that comes from that sun, that darkness is just the dead. Okay, if the world stays dark, everything dies, and that sun brings with it all of those things. But most importantly, what it brings with it is the awakening of consciousness. Okay, literally, you come out of sleep because of the light of the sun. Yeah, and so that illumination that happens when you awaken with the sun, that is dhi. And that's the word, which is also, in the Vedic tradition, dhi is the divine inspiration which comes from God, okay? The poets, the sages who composed the Vedic verses didn't do so as ordinary human beings who would sit down there and think, now let me look up a dictionary to find a word that rhymes with this, okay? They did so because they were inspired by God, who spoke, who filled their body and their mind with this joy and elation, and which spoke words which are not merely a lexical expression, but which are woven into the very fabric of being itself. Okay? And that inspiration, that divine inspiration, is dhi, and that's the root that the word jhana comes from. Okay? So that's when the Buddha was drawing on that word jhana. There's all these kind of connotations within that tradition. It should not need saying that the Buddha divested the idea of jhana from all those metaphysical assumptions which it had carried before, but it kept that association. And if we are to translate the word jhana, and I've kind of been toying with this, you might have some opinions, but if we are to translate it, I would translate it as illumination. And sometimes jhana is translated as absorption, but that's not really literally what it means. The word jhana literally means illumination. It's related to words for like lamps, for light, for glowing, for burning. Okay? That's what jhana means. It means the mind is illuminated. Okay? So, the Buddha talked about this illumination in four stages, which we know of as the four jhanas, and these are perhaps, along with the teachings on Satipatthana, the most important teachings on meditation we find in the suttas, and I will just very, very briefly zip through the teaching on the four jhanas here, and I've spoken and commented on these in a number of places elsewhere, so given that we're nearly at 11 o'clock, if you've got questions, then you probably will need to seek elsewhere for answers to the questions. Anyway, so here monastic, quite secluded from the senses, quite secluded from unskillful qualities, right? Vivicheva kamehi, vivicha akusalehi dhamehi. So karma in the plural means the senses, secluded from the senses, secluded from unskillful qualities. It's the five hindrances. So the mind is unified and the mind is withdrawn from the senses. and has surmounted the five hindrances, enters and remains in the first jhana. It's important to understand that jhanas are a state that has duration. Okay, it's not just a moment, it's a long state, which has initial and sustained application of mind, vitaka vichara. And what this means in the context of jhana is that the mind is like lifted up or placed onto that meditation, that experience of light is like a holding, a lifting the mind up to it and the keeping of the mind onto it. It's not an easy phrase to translate, it's a very kind of subtle concept, but there's like almost like a soft placing and keeping. And then the rapture and the bliss, the bhiti and sukha, born of seclusion. So we've talked about these kind of feelings in meditation beforehand, and so here, those feelings, the feelings of happiness, which you've hopefully experienced at least a little bit of a taste of in the retreat, and these become fully developed and fully purified. They're born of seclusion. Seclusion here refers back, obviously, to the first phrase in the formula, means seclusion from the stimulus of sense activity and of the hindrances. With the stilling of initial and sustained application, so vitaka vichara passing away, they enter and remain in the second jhana where there is internal clarity and confidence, and the heart becomes one. Chetaso ekodi bhava. When I translated this, to translate it as the heart becomes one is almost like an extremely literal translation, even though it sounded a little bit New Agey or something when I was doing it, but it's actually almost word for word what the Pali says. Without additional and sustained application, but with the rapture and bliss born of samadhi. With the fading away of rapture, they enter and remain in the third jhana, where they meditate with equanimity, mindful and aware, personally experiencing the bliss of which the noble ones declare, equanimous and mindful when meditates in bliss, the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and the ending of former happiness and sadness. They enter and remain in the fourth jhana without pleasure and pain, with pure equanimity and mindfulness. This is called right samadhi. So this is the basic definition of right samadhi in the suttas, and it is of course the only definition of right samadhi in the suttas, or at least the only, you know, more abbreviated forms of it, but this is the this is what right samadhi means. So that's the last factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. Why is it the last factor of the Noble Eightfold Path? We all know that we need to develop wisdom and lean towards liberation. So why is samadhi the right factor? It's the right factor because we've already mentioned wisdom under the heading of right view. So if you have right view, the right theory, investigation, reflection, learning through life's experiences, learning through meditation, all of those kinds of things, your vipassana meditation and all of that stuff, then that's all deepening your wisdom. And when your mind has samadhi, then that deepening wisdom will go even further and further and further and lead towards letting go. So that's why samadhi is at the end. It's the key that shifts your wisdom from being kind of limited and shallow to being profound and to leading towards proper letting go. So this is the role of right samadhi in the Noble Eightfold Path. So this is the noble truth of the practice leading to the cessation of suffering. And that's the end of that section on the Four Noble Truths. It goes through the usual refrain sections. So any very brief questions on the Noble Eightfold Path before we wrap up for this morning's panel?
On the first jhana, which has initial and sustained applications of mind, or come to the second, they reject initial and
That's right, that's the difference between them. Okay, so in the first one you have that, what happens throughout the four jhanas is that things fall away. Okay, another thing that the jhanas are actually called is anupubha nirodha, means gradual cessation. Okay? Things are ending as you're going along. That's the point, right? The more that things end, the happier you are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? So all of those things which you think are happiness, when they fall away, you realize, oh, that's even more happy. Yeah? And so you're moving closer and closer. The Buddha said that these jhanas are He said that they are like on the Nibbana, so the Sanchiketa, they're just next to Nibbana. Yeah? They're just next to the ending of all suffering. There's so little suffering left. It's just these very, very subtle qualities of mind that are keeping the mind together in that meditation. Yeah? And it's so close. It's only a very, very few tiny, tiny little things that just drop off a little bit by little bit as your meditation deepens, and then eventually it's all gone. Yeah? There's an interesting sutta Putra is asked, how is Nibbana blissful when there is nothing that's felt there? And he answers, Nibbana is blissful precisely because there is nothing felt there. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And he says, how do you know that? Right? What does that mean? How do you know that? And he says, well, you know that by practicing these jhanas. Right? Because the jhanas are teaching you that the more that you let go of, the happier you are. The more that ceases, the more peaceful you are. Okay, so can I wrap up there?
Sure.
Sorry, but yeah. Okay, we're after 11. I'll just finish off briefly with wrapping up the text as a whole. Then we have the famous final passage from Monastics. Anyone who develops the four kinds of mindfulness meditation in this way for 7 years may expect one of two results: final enlightenment in this very life, that's Jiteva Dhamme Anya, or if there is anything left over, non-return. That's becoming an anagami. So the word anya is always referring to arahantship, so full enlightenment. Notice the phrase in this very life. In Pali is Dhikkeva Dhamme. This is one of a number of idioms in Pali which mean in this life as opposed to in future life. So we had some discussion about this before, and I pointed out that these are some of the basic characteristics of the Dhamma, is that it is relevant to this very life. So if you meditate in this way, okay, then that's what you can expect, 7 years, okay? But not even 7 years. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 year, 7 months. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 month, half a month, 7 days. Then you get one of two results: final enlightenment in this life, or is there anything left over, non-return. One of the Chinese versions then goes on the next step and says, let alone 7 days, if you practice in the morning, you can get enlightened in the afternoon. If you practice in the afternoon, you can get enlightened in the next morning. So obviously, if we're practicing that Chinese text, we can expect to go on faster. So I'm not quite sure what to make of this. I mean, obviously the purpose of this is to encourage us to practice, right? That's what it's about, right? Mm-hmm. It's saying that, you know, if you practice it, you can get the result. How literally it's meant to be taken, I don't know. How authentic is the passage, I don't know. You do find a number of similar kinds of statements in other places throughout the suttas. I think it would be too literal to take it as sort of guaranteeing some attainment or anything like that. But the main purpose of it is to encourage you that if you do this practice, you will see some results. Mm. Okay? That's the basic thrust of this passage. Mm. And then finally, the passage summing up. Monastics, this is the path where all things come together as one, to purify sentient beings, to get past sorrow and lamentation, to make an end of pain and sadness, to reach the way to witness Nibbana, that is the four kinds of mindfulness meditation. That is what I said, and this is why I said it. This is what the Buddha said. Pleased at heart, the monastics rejoiced in the Buddha's words. And so this is the end of the Satipatthana Sutta.